missed you so much.
This is a good day.
Dear Asami, where'd you come from, little cutie?
Dear Cora, I'll destroy you.
Your fiancé?
What do you mean?
This can't be happening.
Well done. She seems very threatening.
Look how cute! Does this mean I'm the master now?
Actually, we're doing fine.
How?
And then she dies.
Think someone is pulling your chain, Gumdrop.
Are you kidding me?
You're a firebender. Boil it yourself.
We're talking minimum 4 hours.
We'll always have Kale.
Hello and welcome to From the Spirit World, a legendary Avatar The Last Airbender and the Legend of Korra podcast for DonBuFang.net. I'm your main host, Dylan, and today I'm joined by Delaney.
Hello.
And Ben.
Hello.
And we'll be being joined by Mel in a little bit, and potentially Ali and Britt, but who knows. Today we'll be discussing the finale again, the series finale of Korra, of course, and Book 4 as a whole. Those two topics will kind of merge together throughout this podcast. Basically, this is our last planned one in which we're discussing specifically Book 4, specifically the finale. The rest of them after this are more specific topics. I don't currently plan on doing like a series wrap-up, so if we get into topics that are more like Korra as a series too, that's completely fine. But I want to like evaluate the finale in the context of the season, just to evaluate the finale again. For context of this podcast, we have done two finale podcasts already, so you can go back and listen to those if you have missed them. Maybe they're more what you're looking for. We did a reactions podcast right after the finale aired, and then last night we did a 3-hour recap podcast where we went 3-hour, yeah, exactly, through scene by scene through the both episodes, and we graded it and such. Today, Ben will be providing a fresh look at it, who wasn't on yesterday, and then me and Delaney have already shared our thoughts, and we'll elaborate more on them. Obviously, no news or anything. I think it'll be interesting to see if Mike O'Brien make a post on the finale at all, on anything involving it.
They have shared articles, which is interesting.
Yeah, Mike on Facebook just shared one article. But it'll be interesting to see if like Brian makes a post. He tends to make a lot of posts. I wonder if they'll comment on this. I don't know.
They're prepping.
It's interesting. I could see them just not commenting on it.
Yeah.
I think that maybe is most likely, but I don't know. Anyway, let's get into it. I guess what I want to do first is go through where all of us are right now on the finale. So like we'll start with Delaney, we'll check in on where she is with her opinions on the finale. We'll go to Ben, he'll give us his opinions from like just in general because he's shared them on the podcast so far, and then I'll check in too. So let's start with Delaney.
So just go.
Just where are you right now on the finale in terms of your reaction, your opinion on it? Yeah.
I'm amazed by this. I'm still on cloud nine. Like I'm just so happy and it's great and I just really enjoyed it. It's awesome. Like everything is just great and it's. Maybe upon more rewatches, I'll maybe have more negative things to say, or maybe as we discuss, but I'm just cloud nine. Great. Amazing. I'm just pumped. Like, I've been giddy for 24 hours straight. Like, I'm just pumped and just excited, like, all day. So.
Yeah. Nice. So, Ben, what did you think of the finale in general, too? And you can give us specific, like, episode thoughts if you have them, or just, like, a general perspective.
Just from a general perspective, I think it was a great way to end the season, and if this is the last thing of Korra that we see, which I guess, unless there's a comic, you know, that's likely to be the case, I think it's a satisfying way to end the show. So it was a good finale. It had a little of everything. It had, you know, your action, and you had, like, some of the quiet, like, not-as-action moments, especially the talk between Korra and Kuvira.
Yeah.
So I thought it was great.
I know you haven't necessarily had a chance to rewatch yet, but about that last episode, we kind of had we had some incredibly high opinions yesterday on that last episode. What do you think of that in the context, that episode in the context of the rest of Korra episodes?
I think it's easily a top five.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, honestly, I think I would need to rewatch the show, not just that episode, but the whole thing, all of Korra, to really have that opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's pretty valid. Yeah. So for context, I guess some notable opinions from us from last podcast were Mel gave it a 10 out of 10. Delaney gave it a 10 out of 10. I gave it a 9.9 out of 10, the last episode specifically of the finale. I said I think it's the second best episode of Korra, behind Korra alone.
And I think it's the best episode.
And Delaney thinks the best. I think Mel thinks it's the best too, yeah. I mean, I assume she does. She also gave Venom a 10 out of 10, Venom of the Red Lotus.
I think I did too.
But there can only be one. But on our scale, 10 is like the best episode you've ever seen. But it could be tied, you know.
Well, I think it's fair that to have a two best episodes, like if you have to go
well,
back
you, yeah, well, if you, if you have one yet. After. Yeah, now it's the best, right?
Yeah.
Yes. I think from a grade perspective, if I had to grade the final episode, I'd say it's a 9.5 easily.
9.5, yeah. Jeff was on a 9.4 on it. So that was our lowest we had last night. Yes, that's right in there. I don't know. I mean, I've seen varying... I feel like we're on the podcast are like the highest on this that I've seen in the fandom. It's interesting.
Yes, definitely.
We've kind of had a reputation in the past of being down on Korra.
Like
book two and book one. And now it's just completely reversed. Like now we like the show much more than anyone else, which is interesting. I don't know. I think I'll say this again when we talk about book four as a whole, but I've seen some people unhappy with the finale, and it just upsets me that they're not able to join us in our happiness with it. Like, I feel like a lot of these people who don't like it at all's perspectives are just not good. And
like, especially for their reasons. That's what
the reasons they're doing it. Yeah. I mean, there's people who are like, this was okay. It wasn't the scale I wanted. And that upsets me too. I understand that. And we'll get into that. Like the scale of the finale not being up to snuff. But at the same time, I feel like, I just don't really get that to a certain extent. It's hard for me not to watch that last episode and just be incredibly blown away. I understand if you're like, oh, it's really good, but doesn't hit me as hard as, you know, because like that special something that's there that I think it has is completely subjective, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with the emotional. Like, that's what makes it for people is like how emotional it is.
Yeah, so let me...
I guess a lot of it is also how emotionally attached you got to the characters and the relationships.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll get into Kurosami some more. We talked extensively about it yesterday, and we'll continue today.
Forever.
And for obviously, yeah. just the rest of time.
Kurosami forever.
Yeah.
Live ever.
Yeah, but as is implied by it being the end of the show. But also, other things I want to discuss in this podcast are, once Mel gets here, the Korra's character arc, and then that'll be a great discussion all four of us can have, and Kuvira's arc as a villain. That's towards the end, but we're going to start, I think, with how was book four as a whole, you know? So we gave our thoughts on the finale. It's interesting. Book four, I think, is generally being seen as, like, good but not great by a lot of people. That's not necessarily the perspective I have, but I think it's going to be interesting, like what we think of it. So let's start with, Delaney. Where are you right now with book four as a whole? And where do you think it stands within the context of Korra seasons?
Well, I think I'm probably like, in comparison to the fandom, like you were saying that, I probably have an unpopular opinion about that. I think book four is better than book three because of, and obviously better than book two. I have book two at the bottom. Maybe, I don't know, book one, I don't know. But book four, especially, like, how they, for me, like, you know, Kuvira, like, I've always loved Kuvira. I was one of the ones who was like, yes, I really like the story arc. Yeah, I was a little disappointed here and there, but this finale, like, made Kuvira the best villain for me in Korra and second only to Azula. And for me, like, especially in terms of the finale, like, this wrapped it all up for me. I really enjoyed book four, and especially, like, with episodes like Korra Alone. And just, I think book four is stellar. And I, not necessarily like super way better than book three, but as of right now, and of course I haven't rewatched, I think book four is above book three.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely not what we're hearing from most of the fandom a lot. Especially the people who are dissatisfied with the finale. You know, they're like, book four is terrible.
And I know it has a lot to do with like Zaheer and like versus Kuvira. And it's like, Zaheer was not my villain. Zaheer was cool. It was interesting. But for me, Kuvira is my villain. Like, Kuvira is the villain I've always wanted.
And we will get into that extensively towards the end of this podcast. Ben, where are you on book four as a whole right now?
Right now, without a lot of rewatching, because believe me, once I get all of the episodes on DVD and such, it'll happen.
Yeah.
But right now, I think book four is probably my second favorite. Book three would be number one. I think book three, what makes me love book three so much was that book was consistently really good.
Yeah.
I mean, episodes throughout that were just consistently at a very good point. And while I think book four had some highs that a lot of book three didn't reach, I also felt that it wasn't as consistently good.
What episodes would you say made it not consistently good? I know it's hard without, like, is there a while ago?
Yeah, like, I think the first couple episodes of book four were really strong, like the first three or four. And then I think a couple after that kind of fell off for me a bit. And
yeah,
then,
in that middle section, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say that's kind of where it got me.
Yeah. Yeah, the hard part about looking at book four in terms of a consistency angle is you have remembrances there as like the elephant in the room, right? That episode is just clearly not up to snuff with the rest of the show. But at the same time, but like, so like me from an evaluation perspective, like I try to ignore it, right? Because it's just not the same show. It's just a clip show. But I guess where I am in general with book four is that first of all, I think Mel kind of expressed those sentiments that you had, Ben, last night. Basically, she was like, book four wasn't as consistent as I would have liked. And my take on it is that book four is incredibly consistent if you ignore Remembrances. Like, and there's some episodes in there I could think you could take issue with. But for me, I make these episode rankings, and I have every episode of book four, and I don't rank Remembrances as a very good or above, which is incredible. That's even better than book three, I think, which had the Earth Queen in my good tier. But at the same time, book three, it's basically the same. Basically, both seasons, book three and book four, were incredibly consistent television. Book four, I mean, the thing with book four is episodes three to eight, right? That's the questionable period. But at the same time, I genuinely liked all those episodes, so I don't, and I think the best one would be episode six, in which Korra faces off with Kuvir and Zhaofu. But they're all still, they're just not as good as we would have wanted. Like, we didn't hit any incredible highs, and then we got to episodes 9 and 10, and those were incredible, right? So it was not up to those high periods. But I think the difference with book three and book four peaked at like the beginning and the end. But I think both are similar quality levels, but they get there at different times. Like, book three was incredibly good in the middle. Book three,
like, they rise and fall in different areas.
Yeah, but it's hard for me. Like, so when I'm comparing the seasons, I think book three is ultimately better. But I could totally see an argument for book four being better, because I think book four had the best two episodes of the entire series in it. So it's hard to ignore that, I think. I think that book four had less incredible episodes. Like, I love looking at which are the episodes that all the all-time greats. And I think there are three of them in book three. There was the Metal Clan, which not everyone agrees with. There's the Stakeout, and there's Venom of the Red Lotus in book three. And I think those are all-time greats and always will be. In book four, there's only two. So Korra alone in this last episode here.
So it's kind of like based on what do you want to go by.
Yeah, there's a lot of criteria, yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways, like, to me, book three, of course, like book two of Avatar. And book four, of course, like book three of Avatar.
That's interesting, because book three is my favorite season of Avatar, which I know is a super unpopular opinion.
I do like that analogy, but I think, yeah, I mean, I disagree with Delaney on that, but I think book four of Korra is better than book three of Avatar relative to their respective seasons. It's hard to compare the season. It's hard for me to compare them. Like, I think the Avatar book rankings are clearly like book two, then there's a little gap, then book three, then book one, then book three, right? Actually, I have book one second, which is most people disagree with. But like, to me, it's three and four are pretty close for Korra. That's what I would say.
Yeah,
and
yeah, then,
I think what's most notable is, I mean, Ben, what would be your ranking? So would it be 3, 4, 1, 2?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's what I have too. I think what's most notable about Korra as a series to me is just the quality gap between seasons 1 and 2 and season 3 and 4. And I think, Ben, you might actually be one of the people that might disagree with this gap existing as much. I think you are higher on the first two seasons than a lot of us were on the podcast, But would you still say that this show has substantially improved since book two?
Well, yeah. And I think with book two, there was definitely, it started like incredibly low.
Yeah.
But then once you kind of got to the end of book two, it didn't reach like the heights that we got in the last two books, but you could sort of tell there was a turning.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, I agree. I think
there are definitely like better episodes in book two than in book one. Like, book one's not necessarily the most solid thing ever. So I think it's important, you know, to compare, like, especially like those time ranges. Like, book one and book two are much more comparable than like book two and book three.
Yeah, I think looking back, a lot of people are gonna remember book two as like this down point for Korra. And I think it's not that simple, right?
Yeah, no, like, after rewatching, like, my opinion on book two has improved substantially.
The thing with book two is that it has episodes 2 to 5, which are just bad.
They're just awful.
And
they're bad for Avatar.
I actually think those are bad episodes in general. I mean, I haven't watched them in 2 years, so I can't speak to it that much. But I do have them in my bad tier on my rankings, which genuinely means they're bad. But at the same time, that's also just below average. So, once you get past that, though, once the animation studio changes, you hit two incredible highs with... A New Spiritual Age and and Night of a Thousand Stars. I think those are two pretty incredible episodes of TV.
Yes.
I think they're in context of the season, like they're definitely worse than a lot most book three and book four episodes. And not most, some. But those are two great ones. And the finale like looks great and it's got like some good dialogue, but then they just clearly had a problem in which they just had to make things happen in the book two finale, which didn't make sense.
Like,
and then they admitted it in the commentary. They're like, these things don't make it, the Janora coming down here.
We don't know what she's doing.
So it's interesting. If like we had a long gap between books, two and three, not that long, but it was like, yeah, but it was somewhat long. And it's like, I never expected the show at that point to hit this turning point, right? And then just become this incredible series, like potentially even better than Avatar,
like,
right?
Oh my God.
Once it gets to book three, even like when those episodes leaked in June of last year, that's when book three started. It was June of last year? June of this year.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
There was like 3 months between
June of this year. Yeah. It's been 6 months since book three started.
You know, Nickelodeon does not know how to handle television shows. I mean, there was this core stuff, and they also mishandled Power Rangers, which I know nobody else on here cares about.
I care.
But, oh, you do?
I do care.
Well, like, I know no one really wants to hear about it, but long story short, they take what should be a single 40-episode season, split it in half, and air it over a 2-year period.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying they have to air all 40 in one whole year, because I understand that's a lot. But what, are you just going to show more repeats of SpongeBob?
It's interesting. Before the podcast, we were kind of talking, we were like talking about Gravity Falls and Disney and putting praise on Gravity Falls, which I love Gravity Falls. But that's actually what Disney's kind of doing with Gravity Falls, right? They're only showing one new episode every 2 weeks or month, you know? So
that's evil.
It's also what Nick does with SpongeBob. Like Avatar and Korra are definitely atypical for these kids to the networks in that they air every week, I think.
Well, like
was there a transition time? Because this wasn't how it was like when we like I don't understand like when did this happen? When did networks decide? Oh, let's be stupid. And
I'm not sure it wasn't always this way, but I can't speak to it.
I feel like it wasn't.
My problem with what they do with a show like Power Rangers, and I'm not a religious watcher of it these days because I just care more about the old school stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, okay, say here's what they do. They have, let's say they take the first 12 episodes and they just air those back to back to back on weeks. Then they take a short break and then they air the next 8. And so at this point, it's like maybe August. And then it goes on break until like next
February. Oh, yeah, that's different, yeah.
I mean, well, oh my gosh.
Well, let's relate it back to Korra. Like, oh, let's put it online. Oh, it's almost over. Let's put it on Nicktoons. What? What?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's clear at this point, Nick, how Nick has mishandled Korra and obviously other shows to a big extent, and we hope that Mike O'Brien don't return to the network. I should say one positive note about Nick is there's certain department within them, though, their online team. Since Korra moved online, I think it had the best possible treatment by their website team, other than, you know, the security lackings during book three, which they then actually rectified every single one in book four. Like, I'm incredibly impressed. I was trying to break career security. I was the one. And you stopped me, so that was pretty impressive.
Good job. Kudos to Nick.
Yeah, like,
then we have to consider, like, content of the finale. Like, okay, Nick, a little bit different.
Yeah, and honestly, we have to, and I mentioned this to both of the past few podcasts, Nick should be given credit for allowing this Kurosami finale to happen, because they could have easily, it's not like, oh, it's online, no, they don't care. They do. It's gonna air. It aired on Nicktoons. It matters to.
It's on their main page of the
website. They gave approval to this, and they should get props for that. That being said, I still stand by my editorial a few weeks ago that said I'm done with Nickelodeon, and I still am. But at the same time, they have done a few like two good things like recently. That's anyway. Back to the show though.
Like, I would join in your boycott of Nickelodeon, except the one thing they're actually doing right is how they handle Ninja Turtles.
They do seem to still care about that show, yeah.
I really like that show, so you'll have to forgive me for supporting them.
I mean, I would say it's a good thing to support Ninja Turtles, because it's arguably can be considered the same type of action animated show as Korra, and once Korra's off the air, it's like just Ninja Turtles and Star Wars Rebels left in the entire country. So, like, support.
And there's nothing wrong with supporting Star Wars Rebels either. Go watch that.
No, I think it's good to support this type of show to make sure this genre doesn't die out, because it is dying out. So anyway, back to Korra and its season structure. That was a nice little detour. But anyway, the quality, so in June of this year, the episodes, first four episodes, four episodes, 3 to 6 of book 3 leaked, and it was just so remarkable how much improved it seemed like the show was. And looking back at book 2, I think that we shouldn't be that surprised, because the end of book 2 was there. It just was missing two elements. One, is the finale not making sense. Like, they just, all they had to do was make the next two finales make sense. Which they did! So there you go.
Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, no more Deus Exes that matter. Okay, number two. More interesting and improved world building. This is kind of a point I want to make at book 3, and I know I've just lobbied praise on book 3, and I will continue to do so, but just looking at the mythological elements they introduced in book 3, it's remarkable how interesting they are. Brought back the Airbender, like, relative to the world they established in Avatar. Like, book 3 finally achieved, in terms of world building, what we imagined could be possible when we heard there was a sequel from Megan Bryan to Avatar. They brought back Airbenders, which was something we always wanted to see not that we wanted Airbenders to come back, but we wanted to see how Airbenders lived.
Well, I feel like this would be arguably more important than them establishing the lore of the Avatar. Like, this was like the most important thing they did.
Well, there's a few things I'm about to say, but yeah, it's like the lore of the Avatar. That's not necessarily something we needed to like build on the world, because that was something in the past, right? But it was interesting. Yeah. But like, bring back the Airbenders, and then you have the opposite side in an Airbender villain with a twisted philosophy. And that was so interesting and so well done.
Yes.
And there's such a good mythological element to bring in. And then you bring in, then we return to Ba Sing Se, this place that we saw prominently in Avatar, and we see the new side of it in the future. Such an interesting thing. So great to return there.
And it's building, and it was still building on Avatar. It's like, we saw these problems developing in Avatar.
Yeah. And then the third thing is seeing the evolution of metal bending.
So important.
That was, we saw it... just created in Avatar, and now we see it full form, create a city created out of it, and then metal bending personified in Sue. I know Lin kind of was to a certain extent, but Sue really, and then connecting connecting that back to Toph's legacy, and then the end, and how they've expanded upon that within the past two seasons, especially in Operation Beifong, just Toph's legacy, metal bending.
I mean,
incredibly interesting.
They introduced these characters, and then by the end of the show, like, they're the newest characters, and it's amazing how much, like, I'm fully invested in them, and you know, like, that development, like, how they're able to introduce this, and then I think that's a indicator of like the writing and how amazing that was in like quality wise of, because I didn't care about Korra until like the end of book 2.
It's cool, Korra the character.
I didn't care about Korra. I hated Korra.
Yeah, looking back is basically intentional, right? Because
it's
part of her arc. So yeah, it's like those elements, I think, plus, you know, the evolution. The big thing, I don't really see a quality difference between Josh and Tim's scripts between books 2, 3, and 4, but the evolution of Mike DiMartino as a writer would be the other big one that's allowed this show to establish. I mean, I think there's 5 best episodes of The Legend of Korra. And we're going to get, this is a episode rankings topic, but I need to say this to make this point. All 5 come in the last 2 books, and 4 out of the 5 are written by Mike. So that's incredible. I mean, I've stated them previously, like 305, 309, 313, 402, and 413. 4 out of the 5 written by Mike. That's absurd. He's been involved into such an incredible writer. And all of this combined created this incredible show. And I guess getting back to book 4, I think book 4 is a continuation of book 3 in terms of this high quality event. I think they maybe struggled with like where the season was overall in book 4. Like, I think we're going to try to talk about some of the like overarching plots, and it's not clear what those are, I think, to a certain extent. But it was like, it's maybe book 4 is like, okay, let's take Korra and focus on Korra, and just this is such this character focused season, as opposed to book 3, which is like, let's introduce all these new interesting world elements. Interestingly, Korra's character in book 3 mostly is her interactions with Asami, and then book four, separate her from Asami, have her build up on her own, and then end back with her back with Asami. That's interesting in terms of the evolution of Kurosami. It's interesting, like someone asked this on Tumblr, when did they decide that they're going with Kuro and Asami as a romantic ending to the series? And I think probably not before book three, but it also could just be in book four. But looking back at book three, it seems like they probably knew in the beginning of book three.
I would agree.
Yeah. I mean, they have these planning stages, right, before the season, where Brian joins the Mike and the writers to plan out what's to come in the season, story-wise. And I really wonder if during that book three planning one, they decided to go with Kuro and Asami.
Well, I think there's even the chance that they, you know, they're like, let's build up, Kuro and Asami are going to be bros, like best buds. And then book three, and then they realized, at the end of book three, natural progression, what could, like, and of course, as a shipper, but like, I would think it appears natural progression to me. So I think that there's a chance that was that between book three and book four that they're like, well, we already have this, and naturally it would appear, it would make sense.
So I think one of the big topics to discuss, of course, on me, and we can get into this a little bit now. I still have two more things I want to talk about before it, but basically, one of the questions is this like random at the end of the series? Not necessarily that it wasn't, like last podcast, I basically tried to counter the notion that this wasn't built up, and it was built up. You have to be so bogged down in shipping to not realize that this was a built-up thing. Book three, they're the most important friendship in the entire show. Book four, you start to introduce romantic elements. It wasn't built up a lot, but it was. So then the next question becomes, it still could be random, though, right? They're having romance at the throw-in at the end of the series, because, again, it wasn't built up a lot. So I think about this, and then I instantly think back to Kata in the Avatar finale, and it's like, it kind of was random because they didn't focus on Katara and Aang at all in the second half of book three of Avatar. Yeah. But I think the difference here is that Katara and Aang was like, they made it a thing in Day of Black Sun, and they built it up throughout the first half of book three, and then it's this thing, and then they left us hanging, and then nothing until Embralan players in a crappy scene there, right? Yeah. So this is different, though, because there wasn't anything there, and they're kind of building it up, and you just get these hints, but then it like culminates. And that's why I think this is better. That's why I think this is less random, because there's nothing expected. We're building up to this point in book four of Korra, as opposed to with Katara and Aang, we built up to something midway through the season, and then it's like, let's continue with that. But they're like, let's pause it, and then we'll come back at the end. And it's like, okay, why did we randomly come back to the end of the series other than thematically? And I kind of agree with that. It was just basically a thematic point and just something to end the series. And not something to end the series on, like, just and where we're going now that with the story and now that the show is over. But with Kuro and Asami, it's like, oh, this is the climax of this very long plot thread that we've been having. And I think it really works on that angle.
I definitely agree.
Any thoughts on this, Ben?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. like on Kurosami in general, or just
what I was talking about being built up. I mean, I'm kind of talking from the perspective of the last podcast too. But basically, they have these elements of the blush in a reunion this season. Then you have Remembrances, the clip show episode where they're talking and looking back. That scene can easily be interpreted as romantic. And then in the beginning of the season, you have Asami only writing Kuro only writing back to Asami, and then they deal with that drama in reunion. So like these elements are not a lot. But they are there, I think, this season.
Yeah. Hmm. I think I would have to go back and watch it all again.
It will be really interesting to rewatch the season in the context of this, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm not as big into shipping, particularly with this series. I think I was into it a little more in Avatar because I just like the characters more, maybe.
I think Avatar was a more shippable show because it was like this continuous story.
So
yeah,
maybe I just wasn't looking for those things.
So I think this is a good question because you could say that like none of us really expected Kurosami. I was like, maybe 15%, but I wasn't really expecting it to happen at the end of the series. So it's not like we're all like, oh, this obvious plot thread is going to culminate here, right? But
sure.
So the question is that because we just assumed that they wouldn't be allowed to do a LGBT plus romance in Korra because of Nickelodeon or because of whatever the culture? Or is it because this plot thread actually wasn't developed to that much of an extent? And I think it's really hard to separate those two ideas. I think they're probably...
Well, for me, it's not, but I do understand what you're saying.
I mean, like, at the same time, though, if you try to separate it, you say, oh, there's really only these three major things that happen romantically between them this season. That's not a lot. It is more than any other ship except for Bolin and Opal this season, clearly. But, or Varric and Julie. Actually, three is about the same as Varric and Julie, but...
Yeah, like, when you think about, though, like, Varric and Julie, like, he literally just proposes to her. Like,
that's true. That also, like, seems pretty random.
That's my thing.
I think, like, that's a little... Yeah.
A lot of people are like, Zurich, yeah, like, this is great. And then they try to, you know, like, argue against Coruscant, but, like, it's the same. Like, and the difference is we don't get, like, a kiss. We do get a very obvious romantic ending, in my opinion, with Coruscant, but... Varric proposes, like, we were all hoping for a kiss or, like, confession of feelings. He pulls out a ring. Like, I mean, we're talking about crazy and, I mean, rushed. And, I mean, it's definitely, the two relationships are definitely very comparable in what we've seen in book three and book four.
I think it's a really good point. Varric and Julie do not have that much romantic buildup, and they go to a proposal, right? That's crazy. And I think that we are way more...
And we play it off a lot because it's Varric, which, I mean, is that really fair?
I mean, I don't even think it's because it's Varric and, like, oh, Varric's, you know, like, Varric's absurd. No, I would say it's because we expect this dynamic between Varric and Julie to be romantic. Like, because for whatever reason, we expect this to be a romantic dynamic, and we don't have that expectation with Korra and Asami.
Yeah.
And I think that tells us a lot about us societally.
Yep, I would agree.
You know, like, I don't think it was, my thing is, I don't think it was because I wasn't expecting it. I just didn't see it as much.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So, based on pre-podcast discussion, my understanding is that you maybe, like, see it as romantic, but not necessarily, like, as overt as others?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean,
so what about it do you think is not, you know, necessarily overtly romantic? Or, like, how do you see it instead?
I see it as a possible romance, but obviously we didn't have something like a kiss. We didn't have, like, any declaration of I love you too kind of thing. And I don't know, it's just, it's hard for me to really describe, but I see it. I do see it. I just don't know if it's as obvious as others have made it out to be.
Well, what do you think the intentions behind it are?
I don't know. I mean, again, this is where a rewatch will probably help me a lot. But maybe a possible budding romance. You know, definitely a strong friendship.
Well, okay. So, I think certainly... okay, just lost my train of thought. I would say it's really, really difficult to watch that scene, like, as we have, like, over and over, me and Delaney. And see that as friendship, you know, like, as intended to be friendship, right? Yeah.
I've only seen it once.
So I would encourage rewatches there.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm gonna completely reject that on that front. But from the angle that it is a budding romance, like, I think that actually is what's happening, right? Like,
no,
it's not like they're kissing and there's this incredible, there's, like, exchange of overt passion. It's like the beginnings of the expression of feelings that have been presented the rest of the season. And to me,
I think that's what's so powerful about it.
Yeah, I think that's what's really interesting, powerful. I think it's so appropriate for, like, their build up they've gotten. And as I talked, there's a lot of the other big topic with Coruscant, I think, is why didn't they kiss, right? Because everyone's super excited about this LGBT plus, henceforth known as queer, representation in children's media, and it's a huge deal. It's incredibly societally important. I presented that on the end of last podcast as well, and it just makes watching this show so much better. The fact that there's not the societal objection to it on that level for the not having representation. And so the question then, when you look at it from that angle, is, well, why didn't we have more overt representation? And the answer to that is because that wouldn't have made sense for these two characters, given what buildup that happened this season. I think we still have the same overt representation. It's just not representation of a relationship that is at the point of making out, like Aang Gitar. It's the beginnings of a romance, clearly.
And especially in comparison to book one. And I'm not, like, just saying this because I don't like Macora, but especially in comparison to book one and how things happened in book one, this is much more natural to me. And that's why I think this is so compelling and beautiful. And that's why I'm so glad they didn't kiss. Like,
See this as like a contrast to Korra just going and going up and kissing Mako.
Yeah. This is a natural, healthy, real relationship.
That's really interesting. I haven't thought of that. So basically in book one, Korra gets this advice from Padma, this really questionable advice. You just got to go for it, right? Don't let him get away or regret it. You have to go for it no matter what. And it turns out really badly. I think a lot of people view book one, Macora, and they're like, oh, that's this incredible romantic scene. And I think that's interesting. Like there's a lot of really, and then the others who, then there's people who embrace it on that angle, and there's people who completely reject it and say, wow, this romance is so bad in book one. But I think what's actually being intended is like to show that this is like this dysfunctional teen romance, right? Like this is not a clear, good expression of feelings. Like kind of in contrast to what it ends up Kurosami being like in what is like a natural romantic progression. I think that's a really good point.
And it's like Mako and Korra weren't friends, and it was with Korra and Asami, they're friends. And, you know, we talk, I mean, this is a thing in society and like books, and we talk about that, you know, your significant other should be your best friend first. And I think that's what this shows, that you know, this is a natural, healthy progression of a relationship, as opposed to the very forced love rectangle in book one.
No, I really, yeah, I think that is really refreshing on that angle.
That's why it's so
important. And they certainly clearly establish them as the closest of friends in book three. They're the most, they are the Wu and Mako of book three times two, right?
Yes.
Like, Wu and Mako is like the clearest friends in book four, and it doesn't really go anywhere. But Korra
and Mako takes a back seat, and it's Asami.
And I think it's going back to like the difference between books one and two and books three and four. I think one of the most interesting things for plot wise, we have these reasons why books three and four that I presented are better than books one and two. But from a plot perspective, books one and two, they have this Mako and Korra romance coming out of this Mako Korra Asami love in book one, right? And I think that was one of the most unsuccessful elements of book one because not necessarily because it wasn't something that could be presented interestingly. I just think they didn't, they missed some key elements, right? They missed the breaking up. They didn't show that. They didn't show, like, and also just the...
It was also sudden.
It was sudden. It's like, it wasn't necessarily compelling to watch this dysfunctional teen romance.
You know, this doesn't make any sense.
They wanted to tell that story, but it wasn't necessarily presented that well. And then they have a less objectionable, but still weak plot in book two of Mako and Korra and their relationship. And then it ultimately, turning into this breakup at the end of the season. And I think that it's so interesting to see transition between books two and three. What they do, one of the easy things they do to make the series incredibly better is they cut off the worst running plot thread. Not necessarily of Mako and Korra specifically, because it also involved the Sasami love triangle in book one. But they cut off the dysfunctional romance focus that they weren't executing on, and instead look at these budding, healthy relationships that are kind of lesser plot threads, and ultimately, and certainly we see in book three, just no Macora, like regardless of what some other people might say. We had that one hug scene that implied it from these cues, but looking back, you can easily explain that as nothing. And in book four, again, nothing between Mako and Korra. And they just stop and they break up in book two and that's the end of it. That's what happened. Like, I know we didn't expect that to be the end of it because of how we view series as a whole in terms of like these progressions that go up, 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 and then culminate in this finale like Avatar did. But Korra's just, they treated Korra differently. Korra, in terms of romance, they had seasons one and two, and then they cut it off, and then they start a new romance in season three, and it culminates in the finale, and it's just so much more of a healthy romance. And now we're joined by Mel. Hello, Mel.
Hey, Mel. Hello.
Yeah, so that was me going on. So Delaney basically brought up this point about how Kurosami is kind of like the opposite of the beginnings of Macora in book one. But we've already discussed that to a certain extent. Where did we even come from before that? I don't know.
No idea.
So it turned into a long rants. I don't know. But I think it is interesting, like, really, because I know maybe Ben and some, I don't know if Ben disagrees with this to a certain extent. I know there's definitely others in the fandom that do. But that, like, this Mako and Goro romance was definitely one of the weaker elements of the show. Like, I don't think it was terrible in book two, but I think it was one of the weaker plot elements. And then to just stop that and then start with a better dynamic. Not that Kornosami was always
better.
You won't
get an argument from me about its weakness.
Okay, yeah, you just were more, and you think it was, you agree it was somewhat weakly presented, but we're just more into it in general than us.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely fair. Yeah, and they start up Kornosami in book three and it's instantly better. Like, I think their friendship in book three wasn't incredible the entire time. In Long Live the Queen, it was really a disappointing episode because we had them as the focus of the episode, but then it wasn't that well presented because of the script, I suppose. But eventually it was overall very, really interesting and good, and them in the beginning of book three was really nice, them in the car and the other scenes, and you know,
it was certainly good that they laid that foundation in book three. The foundation of that friendship.
Yeah, it certainly is what I think made the sort of ending even remotely possible. But I think going back to an earlier point, Mel, so like I think it's really interesting to look at the fact that none of us expected Kurosami to happen. And are you okay?
Yeah, I still think that's really... It's almost comical just that, not that it happened, but that it happened a little
that
bit.
Well,
because
okay.
It was like, well, it wasn't that, it was just that everyone was like, nah, it's not going to happen, like, they're not going to do it, we would really like it, and then suddenly Tumblr just exploded.
Tumblr. Let me present the question that I gave to these two, and maybe you can give your take on it. So the question is, the fact of the matter is, we didn't expect it to happen. Like, you know, I kind of thought maybe there's a chance, but I was still surprised, right? So the question is the fact that we didn't expect it to happen the result of A or B? A, the fact that we thought that this queer romance would never be able to be presented by Nickelodeon, or that Mike and Brian would never be willing to present it, either one, whichever you thought. That's A. We just thought it wouldn't be in the realm of possibility given societal expectations. Or B, because of this incredibly subtle development that it had throughout the season, and we just didn't expect this sudden subtle development to result in this overt romantic ending.
Well, here's the thing. It's not... The choice is very big. It's not B, because...
Why is it not B?
Because the fact that people wanted it to happen, period, means that they were paying attention to this subtle stuff.
I don't know if that's the thing.
And then when you get to the like, okay, so for the majority of book three, you can claim a lot of it is friendship, and the majority of it is friendship, like they're becoming friends, it's great. But when you get to book four, and you have like that blush scene and the scene with the tea, that gets a lot harder to explain another way. And that literally is the only, like that scene about the compliment about the hair is the only reason where I thought, wow, they might actually be doing this. I think the majority of it, Dylan, is that I don't think anyone expected them to actually present this, like Nickelodeon, Mike and Brian, all of it, like for whatever, you know, number of reasons.
Well, I think A is definitely true, but I'm trying to figure out if A explains the fact that we didn't expect to happen completely, you know?
I think that explains it pretty well. I mean, the majority of we, you know, all of us here were like, look at all this stuff. It would be so great if it happened. It won't happen. Like, we were just in this mindset of it won't happen for very good reason.
Yeah.
And then it did. And everyone was A, shocked and surprised, and B, like, incredibly happy that Mike and Brian did this. And it's so cool.
Yeah. So
it was a lot.
So for
the majority of the pushback is shipping goggles and being upset.
Shipping goggles. Yeah. So for the record, I agree with you, Mel, but I'm trying to answer this.
No, I got you.
Just for context, you know, I'm trying to play this devil's advocate here. Like, so what the question we're ultimately trying to answer is, was the Kurosami happening at the end random? Last podcast, we established that it was built up. It was actually built up. It was not built up. Those who say that it was not are not watching the show. Not that they're not watching the show, but they're not like, it's people, the Mikora shippers who are like, this was just completely not built up. Like,
and of course, I think we'll discuss this in another podcast, how we've been trained to look at media and how we're supposed to, how we've been taught to interpret interactions.
I think that goes into
Here's
A,
what
too.
I'll say about the quote unquote.
Well, let me quickly say to try to get into the difference. Like, so randomness would be the fact that, this happens just at the end after not having anything for a few episodes. Episode similar to the cat-ang at the end of Avatar, with not having happened for a few episodes. So one of the differences I ultimately said between, I know this very briefly, between Kadang and Kurosami is that Kadang was something that happened in the middle of the season and then was just paused. And then what happened to it? There's nothing here. And then it's like it happened at the end. So it's kind of random in that regard. Kurosami was built up. So maybe it's more natural this way. There was no happening in the middle of season pause. It was just continuous build up.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few things you could say that come to mind with that. So with the continuous build up and the way it was built up, I've said this like a million times and I'm even getting sick of myself talking about it, but a really good comparison for this is honestly, I think Tara and Willow's relationship in Buffy, which for an entire season was a bunch of platonic interactions until there was this entire episode where some stuff happened and it was forced, you know, like people were put in a position where it all came to a head and then they got into a relationship. So I feel like it was that sort of, and Joss Whedon did that because particularly at that time in the 90s, it was hard to show interactions like that between characters. And I think this is a similar situation where the majority of the interactions were, for the most part, platonic until towards the end, it started to get a little bit more towards romantic. And then at the end, you just have this very overt, like, no getting around it, romantic ending. But in terms of, was it like the base of your question, was it random? I don't think so. But here's the thing that I would say about that is I do think that there is a missing scene between the party and walking into the portal.
Yep.
That's kind of how I feel about that.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a time skip there. Do you think that...
Not even literally a time skip. I think that there's some, like, an emotion... a scene missing emotionally between those two things.
Okay, so you think it wasn't... Do you think it wasn't well done in that regard?
No, I don't think it wasn't well done. It's just I would have, like... It would have been nice to see from point A to point B. You know what I mean? Because, you know, you've got this sort of, oh, yeah, let's go to on this trip. And then you've got this, like, just big...
Oh, okay. So let me maybe try to say what you're saying in, like, terms I would understand. Well, not that I would understand, but maybe in different terms, you know. So,
mm-hmm,
so like you're saying is the romantic development we have is to the point of their talk at the wedding. And then what we have after is, like, this epilogue, and it's... there's something that happens in between that we don't see. And it's not that we needed to see it. It's just that there is something there, and there is more development there. There's more implied romantic development there. And then we get the longing stare at each other into the portal.
That's basically it. And that's the thing. We may not even need to see it, but I do think, and I think it actually may have even been purposeful that there was that gap there. So yeah, that's where I'm
at. So maybe we can even, so from your perspective, like you would say, here's an answer. It's clearly not random. The wedding scene is clearly not random. And then this, like, we have great development up to the wedding scene. And then the thing that happens after that is a little random, but it's supposed to be because we are intentionally missing romantic development in between.
Yes.
I think that's a really good point, I think.
There's a point I want to throw in that, like, talking about random, and of course, I don't have as much, like, this might be a thing, I don't know, because I don't have as much experience watching, like, I don't watch that much TV. Shocker, I know. But I feel like it kind of, I mean, now I don't personally think it was random, but people who might, you know, say it's random, I mean, this might be a fair point that it needed to be random because we're getting to that point where we need to present these things in media and, like, you know, trying to, you know, take away that training that, you know, society's had on us to interpret things. Oh, they're girls, they're best friends, so it has to all be platonic. We have to have things like this. So it's like, no, it's not, bam, it's right here in your face. You have to start looking at this. You need to start looking for these things.
So you
I definitely don't think it's, like, super random.
You could find, I think you can very easily argue for validity despite randomness because of how it's societally important it is. As a default, I would argue that, but I would also try to argue not randomness on top of it.
Like, I don't think it's random, but I think that's something that we, like, that needs to be, like, I just wanted to make that point.
So it should be clear. If you're unconvinced by our arguments that it's not random, it is still very important because we're training people not to have this representation. I don't know. I'm kind of willing to just accept Mel's explanation on its own because I think that's true.
No, like, I agree with Mel.
Yeah, but I also
took 8 years.
It's okay. Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I also just think the thing at the end is also just not that random. So, like, I kind of want to just say, okay, point A, what Mel's saying about we have appropriate development up to the wedding scene. Point B, it also just makes sense because it's just this culmination as opposed to this pausing.
I also think the word, the semantics on the word random are a little, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to, you know, I don't know how else to say it. I'm trying to differentiate.
I mean, I know what you're trying to say, but it's, I guess, because random just seems to have a negative connotation, and I don't want to say that the ending scene was random, because it wasn't. It was just, it was purposely, I think, a little bit disjointed from the things we'd seen before that, because I think the idea here that you get is like, yeah, we're missing the scene where there's sort of a romantic culmination. However, we're also, we're getting the after of that. Like, we missed the climax, we're on the falling action, basically, if you think of it that way.
Interesting. Yeah. I think probably, yeah. No, I forgot what I was going to say. But, no, I don't know.
Then this is why, I mean, unfortunately, it does go back to stupid censorship in children's shows. But I think, honestly, that's what they're doing here, is that they couldn't show you this big scene, but they can show you, okay, like, here's where we are emotionally afterwards.
It's interesting to look at it in terms of, was this, you know, like, censorship, right? Because... I think it probably was a little bit of it. I would be very surprised if we see a post from Brian in a few days saying we tried to get a kiss by Nick, but they said no. Right? I think that's probably not what happened. I think that's almost certainly not what happened.
Yeah.
Well,
no,
not that he wouldn't say it, but the fact that that would be true. You know, I would be very surprised if that was true. I think it's possible that they didn't think the culture was there enough for the kiss, so they didn't try it. But at the same time, we have this validity in. In what we got was that it was appropriate for their current romantic climate to just have this handhold.
Like, I didn't, like, after rewatching, like, I'm like, we didn't need a kiss. Like, this was this is how, like, this makes sense for these characters that they didn't kiss.
Let me read this, what Sam's thoughts on this that she sent in. She made a post about this because I think this is a good time. So let's see if I lose my voice. It seems like I'm starting to after 3 days of podcasting in a row. Sam says, I think there's a certain innocence about the Koranasami handholding that makes it a better ending than a kiss or whatever. It almost makes it more deeply romantic in my mind anyway. It's like they're saying, out of all the people in the world, I choose you, and I'm glad I'm going on this journey with you. You are the only person on this earth that I want to do this with, and I trust. And they're not all sucking face to prove that. It's an ending that makes sense for their arc in the show. It's like the beginning of their journey together, literally, and perhaps hopefully romantic wise. It's Korra excited proposition to go on this vacation together with just the two of them. It's just the two of them. It's smiling at each other. It's holding hands. It's them looking at each other rather than the portal as they're walking into it. And it's that swing around when they're each holding both their hands together. It's so sweet. It's really innocent. Like I said, it's the beginning of a romance. I was watching this documentary once, The Celluloid Closet, in which is appropriately about homosexuality in the movies from the beginning of the industry until the early 90s. And Susan's friend had said something about, what's the most sexiest moment, the first time people touch? And while I don't think that this ending was sexy in any way, it was very chaste, I think... it still holds that power. It still holds the mountains of butterflies. The first time people touch and connect, not in a hug, not in a hug, a touch on the shoulder. What we've seen before in their interactions, not something of comfort when one is sad and the other is trying to help, but holding hands, going somewhere, and going somewhere together. A happy touch, a powerful one. So that's what Sam is saying. I think that's one of the things she said. Really, so I think that's true in its own.
Well,
it's a very powerful
moment.
Talking
about it, like, just validates, like, everything that Sam has said. Like, would we be talking about this so much if they kissed? Like, that's why
I think we're kind of talking about it because it wasn't a kiss. But.
I think a little bit of it also is, if they kissed, it would be a break in tension for the audience. And the nice thing about this is that there's still a lot of tension there because we didn't get that.
Yeah.
It kind of builds
and
up until the last possible moment, you know?
That way.
Like, it's not, it doesn't build, I think that the kiss kind of builds up until the beginning of a kiss. This just completely goes into the answer.
Yeah, and then the second character's kiss, you're like,
it's over. You know, I think it's Sam's, I love Sam's point about it, the fact that they're looking at each other and not at the portal. They're going into, like, that's true. One would assume you'd be looking into they're looking at each other as they enter the spirit world. This is the first time Asami's been in the spirit world, and she's not frantically looking around, she's looking at Korra, right? That's extremely powerful.
When Asami drives, she looks at Korra, and everyone pays for that one.
Yeah, so I mean, this was basically the other big point. The two big points I want to talk about, of course, on today were, was it random and why wasn't it a kiss? That's because, like, I saw a Mary Sue article about the fact that it's like we would want it to be a kiss for a more overt queer representation. But I think this is overt representation on its own, and I also just really love how this works in the context of Kurosami in books 2, 3, and 4. And I think Sam kind of summarized that. We've talked about it a lot. Any you know, any other thoughts on this, Mel?
No, I read Sam's post earlier today, and I thought it was really yes. Like there's quite a few reasons why I don't think there was a kiss, and I do think that Sam explained in a good way why we didn't need one.
I kind of love where we ended up with this.
Yeah, which it's funny because last night we were all like, or whenever it was, we were like, oh, what about a kiss? But at this point, I'm like, I don't think I really would have wanted one because
that's who I am. Yeah,
the aforementioned reasons.
From like an overall level, like as a person, I still maybe would have preferred a kiss for the representation, but from a show watching perspective, I think this is better.
Like for these characters, this is the best thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Any other thoughts, Del or Ben?
No.
Okay, so let's move on to now for something completely different. Let's talk about how this finale functions as a season and series finale, because that's one big criticism I've seen, is that it's like, this doesn't feel like a series finale, and this doesn't tie up what's happened in book 4. So I kind of want to talk about that. So how does this finale function as a season finale, as a wrapping up of what we saw this season? And I assume we're going to get into Korra's arc here. So I think that one thing that's notable about this season finale as a season finale, and we'll get into it as a series finale after, is that not that much happens, you know? Like, it's like Kuvir is defeated, and that's it. You know, like, it doesn't really, and we conclude Julian Varric, and Gore is defeated, and, you know, that's it, right?
Well, it's interesting that we feared this. Like, the entire time we've been talking about, like, all the podcasts this season, we're like, oh, this is not what we want, oh, and then we get it.
I was really worried, yeah, so I was really, really worried that what would happen in this finale would be what happened. So, I was like, okay, we don't have anything, like, we just have this completely pedestrian fight sequence between Korra and Kuvira. And then just like they did this battle and Kuvira is defeated, and that's exactly what happened. But I also think that's not what happened. Like, I think the extra was Korra and Kuvira in the spirit world, right?
Yes.
That was the extra, and just the extended epilogue and the Korra and Tenzin's talk and the Kurosami at the end. I think that's what I was looking for, and that is the best part of the finale too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really want to keep talking about one point I brought up, and I think I'm losing my voice, so this is going to be interesting, in terms of this is a conclusion. So I think, so let's start from the beginning. Like, so this season, I think, book 4, is about Korra's mental state. This is the primary plot line of the season. I mean, obviously, like, ostensibly, the plot of the season is Kuvira and the Earth Empire, right? And that is one of the biggest plot thread, but character interaction wise, the big thing is Korra's mental state. That just dominates the beginning of the season, and even into episodes and towards the end of it. So I think so it's interesting though, because that plotline was also resolved in episode 9. So it's like, what is this finale going to do with Korra's mental state from book 4? And the answer is, it doesn't do that much with it, right?
Yeah.
So I guess, Mel, like, I think you're very happy with this decision, right? So, like, how do you see this finale as a conclusion to this plot arc, or was it even a conclusion?
I honestly think it's a situation where it's on the afterburner, because I do think the big thing for Korra was Zaheer's thing, which is unfortunate because it was such a short scene and it probably deserved more. But we don't see her struggling from that point on, and here we kind of see her implementing that, where she chooses not to go into the Avatar state. She chooses not to beat up Kuvira. In fact, she pulls her out of the rubble and tries to talk to her, and does talk to her in the spirit world. And, you know, it's difficult to talk about it in terms of the season, because I see it as a 4-season arc. I do think the stuff with Zaheer, though, could have been expanded or deepened a little bit more, because I do think it was, like, what, a 2-minute scene with Zaheer where basically we ended all of her mental strife, seemingly. So.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to, like, especially, like, with the finale and how, like, everything happened, that it's hard to separate this, her struggle with her mental state from her 4 the four season character arc for Korra. Like, it's like, and I think that makes it make, I mean, obviously it would have been better if they had lengthened it in with Zaheer, but it almost makes it a little bit better. Like, I don't like, and it's kind of weird because we were focusing so much on the mental state and then it stops. And then we get like core, like then we have the completion of Korra's character. It's just, I'm still not sure how I feel about it. It's just strange.
Yeah. Quick update on the other two. Britt probably will be joining us. Allie says she's very sick. So,
better, Allie.
And I don't know why she's still going to be on, but you know. Anyway, because you know she's in bed already. So here's my thoughts on this. And I really want to push this one point that I tried pushing last night, and I don't think I got much reception to it from anyone. But here's, I'll present it again. I really think that Korra's interactions with Asami at the end of the series is the culmination of Korra's mental state arc, and I think it's really beautiful in that it is. Like, I really like how, like, we get a literal end of the Korra's mental state arc in episode 9, from it being presented ostensibly, and then we kind of have it subtly, like, merge with Korra, just how she, like, sees herself in the world and how she's going to interact with the world at all, because that is also just inseparably tied from her mental state, is just how she interacts in the world, right? That's the same thing. So, like, it kind of gets into what's Korra going to do from here now that this giant thing is over. She's going to solve the problem at hand, and not only is she going to solve it, she's going to solve it in a way in which she's learned from her past, and she's learned compassion, and like she says, and then where's she going to go from here? She's going to enter this, she's now developed this throughout her entering these sort of problems in book 4, she's maintained this one relationship, and she's going to continue on with that and expand that relationship in a romantic way. And it's really good from her, from a level of having a support. Like, she has her support group. That's what was lacking in the beginning of the season, was she had no one. She ran off and she had no one. And now not only does she have someone, she has someone in the most intimate possible way. And I think that's really incredible, kind of as like a conclusion to that.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's a little, it could be seen as a little naive in terms of, love solves, you know, solves problems.
I also think that the majority of this build up for them was getting them to be friends and seeing them as friends. So I'm willing to accept that, because
this is another reason why it's so great that they didn't kiss, was because, Korra has support here. She has this intense relationship, which is what the staring into the eyes like implies, instead of she's just, you know, like in love with someone, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's so much better on that level too.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
We are joined by Britt. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so we're talking about how, I don't know what we're talking about, but
the conclusion to like Korra's
Korra's mental arc. I don't know, Ben, do you have any thoughts on this topic?
You know, I mean, the last podcast I was on, I had quite a talk about that, so I don't know if I want to go back to that again. But, you know, if I can backtrack a little bit to what we were talking about a bit ago, I feel like a lot of the arc was resolved after meeting with Zaheer.
Yeah.
And that perhaps the ending in the finale was the ultimate cap off to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had asked, you know, did we expect it to come because we didn't think they would do it, or if it just wasn't built up? I don't think it was because I didn't think it would happen, but I don't know if I was looking for as many, like, romantic possibilities in the series after book 2.
Yeah.
Because once Makora got really bad, I was like, I really don't care anymore. And I'm not a shipper. I really am not. So, you know, I was only surprised because I wasn't looking for romantic buildup.
I think that's a good point. Like, all of us were kind of expecting, we weren't expecting a Korra, and at a certain point in book 4, we were expecting a no romance end for Korra. And I think part of that is the result of, this season being the focus on her mental state.
Yeah.
And
I have a friend who watches Korra casually, and she was very surprised at the romantic ending just because she wasn't expecting any sort of romantic ending.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point to bring up then.
And I think that's maybe why I wasn't as excited about the ending. Not because I like, oh, I hate this, or oh, it's so random. It's just I wasn't looking for it.
Yeah.
Well, what about what do you think of my interpretation of whether you like that you see my interpretation as what happened in the show or not? How do you like that from a thematic perspective of this her developing this intense support with Asami and like that helping her like really cap off her problems this season?
I think it's very valid. I mean, I think the big thing that would help me whether I think it was built up well or not is I need to rewatch it. I really need to go back, particularly with book 3 and 4, rewatch it all, and I can probably have a better understanding of what I think.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to watch back books 3 and 4 from the Kurosami perspective. Yeah,
maybe I saw more as friendship buildup than romantic buildup because, again, I wasn't looking for romance.
And again,
I saw it as like, oh, friendship, great, because Cora never really had a female friend when she was growing up.
Yeah, well, that's certainly what that was in book 3, you know, like that's what they're presenting there.
And I guess maybe that's what I saw in book 4 too, just because, again...
I think that's what most of us saw for the majority of book 4 too. Like, we saw that blush and we were like, okay, that's romantic, but everything else here could totally be seen as friendship.
I think the transfer from them from platonic to romantic was very subtle. And I do like that. I do like that it was kind of just naturally.
Kind of going back to something we're talking about is that like I think that that transfer to a certain extent is presented on screen,
at the end.
That's what's so interesting about it. Like, and I think I could, from that perspective, I could see people being confused as to how this isn't romantic ending. But at the same time, this is like it's how we were talking about before, how this was just so powerful in that. This is the conversion and expression of their romantic feelings that they've been like hiding or like building up all of book 4, not necessarily on screen the majority of the time, but yeah. But anyway,
it's also something that they finally had no time to do it because most of book 3 and book 4 were very, you know, jam packed. I don't think either of them were looking for a romantic relationship at this point. So I'm kind of glad that they got a nice moment at the end to be happy.
And I do like how they presented it at the end very much. I mean, just the subtlety of it was very nice.
Simple
but nice.
Maybe from a perspective of from a series that has had just these overt kisses this entire time as like as this expression of romance. It's really refreshing to look at Kurosami at the end and then also Jinora and Kaiwa, who never kissed, as like these clear couples who turn out to be who just don't need to express these feelings this much on screen. Although I don't think that's really what's happening with Kurosami. I think it's again the beginning of that. Anyway, let's transfer back to our discussion as book 4, looking at the finale as a season finale first, and then we'll get into series finale. But I think kind of what we've arrived at in terms of what I think is the main plotline of book 4, Cora's mental state, is that it's hard to look at the finale as a conclusion to the season from that angle because that plotline basically concluded in episode 9. So in that regard, they don't have to mention the main plotline of the episode. So what other things happen this season? How do we think of this as a conclusion to Kuvira's expansion Earth Empire throughout the season?
It's great. So important. Yes. This for like this, I needed this finale for Kuvira because like I know, like, I'm one of the few, like, I've loved Kuvira since the beginning. Yes, there were issues with her, and I was like, no, don't do this to me. I love Kuvira, and this was it. Like, this is what I needed. This is what I desperately wanted, and I didn't think we were going to get it. Because this was my biggest concern for the season. It was like, okay, how am I going to care about Kuvira? How is this going to matter, like, for Korra, for the world? Like, how is this going to matter? Like, why? Like, don't give me an Ozai ending. Don't give me Zaheer rambling. Like, I need this, and they gave it to me, and it was great. Like, and I think as, for Kuvira, like, it functions very well, not only with her, like, her arc as a villain, but, like, her arc as a character.
Okay, let's get into Kuvira as a villain. So this entire last part of the discussion is all going to be intertwined. So I think that there's one of the things, let me preface this a little bit from some more things. One of the things we're going to come to the realization of here, I think where we're going to, is that there weren't actually that many running plot threads going to the finale. Yes. They like, actually concluded a lot before the finale. Like, one of the other major plot threads...
I think that's part of why the finale was so good, is there was a lot of stuff that wasn't rushed.
Yeah, I definitely think it wasn't rushed. Now, it might be because of that. It's a good point. But, like, one of the major plot threads that was throughout book 4 was Bolin and his relationship with Opal and him working for Kuvira. And they actually resolved that in episode 10. So, you know, Bolin doesn't really need to do anything in the finale, although he does. He doesn't do that much. But the one big thing, I guess, is Kuvira. And, Mel, I guess last podcast you'd expressed how, you thought that Kuvira was you've loved how Kavira has ended up as a villain. So, like, I guess, what do you love about this ending for Kavira in the finale? Oh,
gosh. I honestly think part of it, and this probably sucks because it kind of takes away from her as her own character, but I just think the big thing is... two things. So the one big thing is obviously the connection with Korra's own arc and sort of the mirroring of that. And, you know, the way she's, not to use a cliche, but the flip side of the coin when it comes to Korra. But the other thing I like is that, you know, Sue's line was very interesting. Like, she is a complicated person. Maybe, you know, it wasn't presented that much until the very end, but I think of our villain, she had the most concrete, because, I mean, a lot of people love Amon. I don't know. I think she had the most concrete sort of reason, motivation, characteristics, and... Again, going back to my favorite thing is character choices. And I was thinking about this today when I was monotonously checking people out for their Christmas shopping, was the line where she's telling him, Korra's like, when they're in the spirit world and she tells Korra, she's like, Sue turned her back on the Earth Kingdom. You were gone. What choice did I have? And it's just, a lot of it's the line read from Zelda Williams, but the way she says it is just so interesting because it's like, you can see where there was a break between the person we saw vaguely for a second in season 3 and this person, because it's almost very childish. And I think that's super interesting that she's very much this sort of vulnerable person who doesn't want to be vulnerable, still very much someone who didn't truly really get to mature in an independent way because of just everything that happened. And I just love that line where she was like, Sue did this and you were gone. What was I supposed to do? Like, she, and the bit before that where she's talking to Korra and she's like, why did you save my life after everything I did? And when Korra says, you have to know what you were doing was wrong. And the fact is that Kavira did know, I think. And I love that line too, in reference to that, if you had all just surrendered, this wouldn't have happened. Because that's such, like, a 12-year-old thing to say. Like, if you've just done this, then, you know, you're like, playing a game. Yeah, if you're playing a game with someone, you're like, if you were just had lost like you were supposed to, or rolled a 7 like you were supposed to, this would be fine. Like, it's literally a child who threw a giant temper tantrum. Not that this whole Earth Empire thing was a temper tantrum. Like, that was her... Thank you, Ben. That was her, you know...
Sorry, I just love that parallel. That's perfect.
Well, that's the thing is like, you know, the Earth Empire, that was her, you know, trying to step up and be like, okay, my country's vulnerable. I'm going to be the person to step in and do this because nobody else is going to. But when it wasn't, when she was getting pushback on it, when it wasn't going the way she wanted, she like flipped a desk.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. And it shows I think that's so cool.
Like, and it shows her weakness.
Literally.
Like I'm saying weakness, like not in a bad way, but like weakness as a, like, you know, immaturity as a person, like, she's human. Like, this is showing cracks in her armor, which I think was just so important, like, to see her as a villain. And it's, again, like, the parallels with Azula, like, you know, and Azula was a child. She was 14, which, you know, we can talk about.
Yeah, okay.
We always ignore
that. But, you know, like, but, you know, Azula is, I mean, she's, like, all the characters in Avatar, for the, like, young, and she has, you know, all these issues with her parents and her family, and especially her mom. And then we have Kavira, who her parents abandoned her, and we're seeing this very immature, like, she acts like a child. And then, and it kind of the thing with Batara, it's like, oh, well, sorry. And, you know, like, if, you know, Korra's gonna stand in her way, like, her only alternative is to destroy her, which is a very black, like, Kavira has a very black and white view on how the world's supposed to work.
And this is also interesting, too, because you take that, so if Korra and Kavira are mirror images of each other, then to beat Kavira, Korra had to mature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had to be the, you know, and I think that's...
She had to put on her great girl pants.
Great narrative symmetry, because it's awesome. It's just, it's awesome.
Is the conclusion to this kind of that, we love this end... This Kavira's arc in the finale, like, as a conclusion to Kavira's arc because of how it relates to Korra and, like, how they intertwine.
A bit. That's one of the reasons, but I still do love, like, just the way that, like, and it comes out at the end in her bits of talking to Korra, where she's just talking about the reasons she did things. And again, going back to that, she's a child who threw a temper tantrum after she didn't get her way, which is a completely simplistic way of putting it, but also very accurate.
Yeah.
And I think she as a character by herself is awesome.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Fortunately, it does require a lot of digging because we don't see a lot of that presented. It comes in little lines and snippets, but I think it's enough that it's worth digging for.
Well, I would argue that, like, for me, like, it wasn't necessarily as, like, I didn't feel like neat, like, I had to dig as much, like, you know, earlier in the season. Like, it was like, oh, look at this character, like, this is interesting. Of course, you know, it dropped off for a while, as we have discussed. But I think that's what's so interesting is, like, Kuvira, as much as her arc, you know, intertwines with Korra's, like, she does stand alone. And that's what's so amazing about it, is that Kuvira is still her own character, and she has her own arc, and it's really interesting. Because I think, like, we do see a lot of, like, Kuvira, and especially in the last few episodes, especially her interactions with Batar.
Yeah.
Like, that was really important, that hug, and, like, seeing, like, oh, Kuvira does have a heart, and then we're like,
he has feelings.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think looking at the finale as a conclusion to Kuvira's arc is, like, interesting, because there kind of wasn't anything that, like, needed to be wrapped up in the finale. Like, for Zaheer, it was like, okay, we have to see what Zaheer's, like, ultimate plan is with Korra and what he's going to do at the end, and, like, how his motivations are going to come into play. Kuvira's motivations are just very transparent the entire season. We don't have a big confession scene with Kuvira's motivations. And it's
was
just
very nice.
And it's
it was
like
very nice. There was no mystery.
There's no mystery. Yeah. It was just very transparent. And it's like, okay, this is just like whatever happens, happens. You know, like there's no real like, oh, what's gonna happen? Like there's no like expectations needed. So yeah. I don't know. I honestly don't know how to look at this as a conclusion from this perspective, because there wasn't really anything hanging in the balance.
No.
Well, I think for our concerns from the season, and we've discussed, you know, oh, Kuvira, oh, and we talked about how everything we didn't want to happen happened in the finale, but they did it in such a good way that we're not upset about it.
Pretty much. I feel like that's very much what happened. It's like, we had a shipping ending, we weren't mad. We had Kuvira and Korra talking in Spirit World, and we weren't mad.
Well, like, yeah, but like...
We had the giant robot.
What we mean here is that, like, we didn't really want this, like, pedestrian finale, where it's like, yep. Oh, there's this fight scene and Korra and Kuvira face off, and then she's defeated at the end. But I think what the difference is between what happened and that is just the last two acts of the last episode are just Korra and Kuvira interacting, not fighting, right?
Like, we fleshed out Kuvira, and that's what we needed.
It's like, and her dynamic with Korra.
Like it wasn't necessarily a plot hole, but like a plot thread, as you were saying, but like we had to flesh out this character.
So like, I mean, where we're ultimately going to get with this, so I'll preview my opinions on this, is I don't think Kuvira's character is honestly that deep, and I don't think the fleshing outness that we got in the finale was all that much. But I did love...
I don't think she's deep.
And I did love what we got.
She's complicated, but complicated.
I don't think she's deep at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I still think she's awesome.
I just love her. Like, I just love Kuvira.
It's the difference between being complicated and being deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think what was presented with her in the last, especially the last two acts of the last episode, were really, really nice. And I think really did conclude her arc well in the season, even though there wasn't necessarily much hanging in the balance, it was still a nice conclusion. I will say the one thing is that it was maybe, the themes were maybe too overtly presented. We are, you and I are alike, we're both hot-headed and, you know, like
yeah,
no, that.
That's,
like,
yeah,
so
that's
that
also how, you know, Korra would talk to her about
it. I think Korra might overly say it, but I don't know if she's called herself.
I don't know, Korra's not, you know, Mel, she's not going to English writer, she's not going to make an elaborate metaphor.
Right, well,
I don't know if that was an insult or not.
Yeah, not sure. So, I think, so Kuvira, I think, like, okay, yes, they wrapped up, Kuvira concluded well. The mental state arc wasn't really addressed that much, but that was already concluded during the season. What else is there? Like, what other plot threads are hanging in the balance?
I mean, that's why we got to see
Jerick
and Jerick get married.
All right, so Wu and Mako's interactions. Okay, that ended with Wu leading the people out of the city with his singing and stuff, and then ultimately abdicating and turning the Earth Kingdom into a democratic state system, which I think was very well presented and very satisfying.
Like, yeah, there weren't plot, like, for me, it's not, like, plot threads, it's, we're capping off characters.
Yeah. Bolin was already capped off, as I mentioned. Mako, I don't, like last.
Mako yes, didn't have a plot this season.
That's the thing. Mako
didn't. Mako didn't need Mako's... one, but he didn't have one. I mean, he did stuff. He,
well, it's interesting.
His character was completed. So.
Well, what's interesting is because we talk about how like, you know, we don't really need to like we consider Remembrances like completely separate from the season. Like, it's not necessarily like an episode in the way we'd want it to be, but it's interesting because what we're presented in that episode is what gets capped off in the finale.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Remembrances was a very direct what's going to happen ship-wise in the,
yeah,
in the finale. It's like Mako, I talked about his arc pretty, and I defended his arc pretty extensively last podcast, but there wasn't, he didn't, like, his interactions this season were defined by Wu and stuff, and ultimately I think he's concluded extremely, him and Korra's whatever is concluded extremely satisfying in a platonic way, and that scene was very good. And I think that him and Wu maybe wasn't satisfying enough because there wasn't any.
I was very happy.
I don't think him and Wu was like, there wasn't any promise of any future interactions.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think their friendship went anywhere. So I think it was kind of disappointing in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Mako sacrificing himself again. You know,
that was very. I felt
that it was a good character moment for him. I don't think there was a clear arc.
I think if he had like that ended died, with that, it would have. Not to say that I want him to die. I've come a long way since Mako season one, where I wanted to kill him. But like, I feel like if he had died and that like sacrifices himself would have been full circle arc wise, because he would have come from being a very hot headed, selfish character to being, you know, who only really cared about one person, that was his brother, to dying for a bunch of strangers.
I could definitely see his like his sacrificial thing in the finale, and to a certain extent, it doesn't matter whether he lived or not because he did the sacrificial element. Yeah. Like, I could see that being a really good conclusion to his character arc throughout the entire series, right? Like Britt said, him going from really selfish to this selfless person who cares about his friends.
Like,
a lot.
Season-wise, not necessarily conclusive to any arc, but he definitely season-wise.
Yeah.
And he learned from Wu to care about people who are not necessarily serious or great, because Wu's just kind of silly and ridiculous. Like, his scenes where he chases him into the Earth Kingdom version of a Burger King was, you know, pretty interesting, because Mako season one would have just gotten really mad and left.
Yeah, that's interesting. Teaching Mako, Wu teaching Mako like compassion, or maybe seeing the good side of people and stuff like
that. Yeah, teaching him to like deal with his anger, because he could be annoyed at Wu, but he couldn't do anything else, so he learned to deal with it.
That's interesting.
I wish we'd gotten maybe a little bit more of that, or more defined.
I would have just loved something with those two characters at the end, you know?
Yeah,
that would have been
hashtag
nice.
Wu Go, yeah. So
hashtag all of the friendships.
So I guess the only
hashtag, please give my ass.
The only other thing I think we can talk about at this as a conclusion to the season would be just in terms of it being this high point, you know, this climax of the season. And I think certain people are disappointed by the lack of stakes and lack of everything. But I think certainly if you look at this from a season angle, I think the stakes were as much there as book three. As I think book two was bigger, but in terms of book three and book four, I think they're about the same. We battled this giant robot. The entire city was online. Stuff like that. There's certainly a lot of action.
They did destroy the entire city.
Eh, who cares?
I mean, they destroyed the center of the city. And there's a giant
The middle.
Well, no, but I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Just the middle, the lady.
Especially that scene with, like, all the beams around. Like, we have demolished. Like, that's what I was like, rest in peace, Republic City. That's who died in...
Seriously, Kavir, like, what do you think you were doing? Like, what if you just destroyed the whole city? Then you're going to be the conqueror of a bunch of ashes. Good luck dealing with that, because then you have to fix it.
I don't know if she would have minded. I guess she, like, wouldn't have. I guess she wouldn't have minded, though, as long as it's part of the Earth Kingdom.
Fix it, because if you break it, you bought it.
Yeah. So I guess, like,
just look at Russian history.
So ultimately what I would say is that, let's not get into Russian age. So ultimately what I would say is that I think this is a good conclusion to the season, like as a season finale. What do you think, Mel?
I do. Yeah. I mean, not a huge amount happened in the season finale because, like you said, like, not a lot happened in the season. There wasn't a huge amount of running threads. There weren't huge stakes really until the very end. So I think it works as a season finale.
Ben, any thoughts?
Think it works as a finale, yes.
Yeah. Delaney, Britt?
Yep, I think it works as a season finale, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so how about as a series finale? That's the next question.
Yes.
So this
I didn't
is...
get to answer, Dylan.
I said Delaney, Britt. Okay, yes, Britt.
Oh, I'm one person. I am not an offshoot of Delaney.
Yes, as a season finale.
I thought it worked very well.
Okay, thank you. as a series finale, this is the big one, right? So Here, okay, so let me go on a little bit of a speech here. So a lot of people were expecting this this Avatar-like series finale. And here's the thing. People, I think, continually watch Korra too much from an Avatar perspective. Like, in terms of a plot structure. The fact of the matter is, Avatar was a continuing hero's journey, season one, season two, season three. They're all the same. We had different individual season villains, but the overall villain was the same in each one. We go into different places, but the overall goal was the same. And the entire season one culminates in the series three finale. That's just what happens. Like, we're building up to this high point throughout all three seasons. So that's one thing, and that's the traditional story, and that's what a lot of people approach Korra with. But here's the thing. Korra isn't that. The events of Korra Book 1 have almost no relevance on Korra Book 4. Korra Book 1 is its own series, basically. Korra Book 2 relates to Book 1, but is also basically its own series. And in fact, the Korra Book 2 finale is basically a series finale to Books 1 and 2, or to just Book 2. Then we begin basically this new series in Book 3. And then Book 3 ends, which is basically a series finale to Book 3. But now we have this conclusion in Book 4, and the fact that I think looking at this as a series finale is almost wrong, because this isn't a finale to Book 1. This is only a finale to Book 4 and maybe Book 3. And I think that that's really important to view it as, because we don't need this to be bigger than the Book 2 finale. Like, I know it's a series finale, but the fact of the matter is the Book 2 finale is basically as big as they could go, and they went there on their own because that's how many episodes they had at the time. Eventually they got expanded for 26 more episodes, but at the time they only had the original 26, and so they went as big as they could, and, you know, then you're going to start over. And Korra is four miniseries that relate but are not necessarily the same. Yes, Books 3 and 4 are very interconnected, and you could look at those two as a unit because they had the order for those 26 episodes, and they made Lin and Subi incredible running threads and everyone there, and they changed villains, but they have continuing plot lines, although, you know, there's more Red Lotus members out there. Nope, never got back to that. But it's...
They're going to come back and make the Earth Avatar really mad.
The Earth Avatar is going to be Red Lotus. That's what's happening.
Yes.
No, that makes no sense. But
it's Red Lotus.
But I really think it is like don't stop looking at this as a conclusion to Book 1. It's not.
Does anyone else ever like imagine Dylan's hand gestures when he talks?
I am making hand gestures. Yeah, it's true. That's the thing though. Like, this is one of the reasons why Korra shippers aren't understanding what's happening in the series. This is like, oh, this is a series finale to Book 1. No, it's not. This is not a series. This has nothing to do with Book 1.
The thing that has to do with Book 1 is in terms of Korra.
This is the reason
that this is a series finale. Dylan is, sorry, I sat up, is because, you made me sit up, is because, this is the conclusion, the talk with Kuvira, and the reason that it happened in the first place is the conclusion to Korra's arc. And you misused the word hero's journey, but that's fine. I mean, Aang's story is, you shouldn't have said it, because guess what's going to happen? Aang's story is, you know, the quest plotline. It's very much the Lord of the Rings. We have to go do this. And I talked about this once before. Korra's is a bit disjointed in terms of plot, but the one common thread between all four of these seasons is Korra's character arc and character growth.
I agree.
You know,
as the legend of Korra, this is the series finale for Korra.
Talked about the apotheosis and that whole getting poisoned stuff. And then what we've got here is that basically, because that's the climax to arcs in terms of hero's journey, like that's the biggest point. And then after that, you've got the return cycle, which is, and all this stuff with Kuvira is like the refusal of the return, magic flight, all that stuff until you get to the, I'm not going to go into specific ones, until you get to the end, which is freedom to live, which is the hero returns to a sense of normalcy back into the world they were in before all this started having changed. And that 155% happened.
155% happened.
Over the course of four seasons.
I completely agree. This is the conclusion of Korra's arc. I think it's not necessarily important, but we should note that it's not like Korra's arc in Book 1 was made with the intention of it ending here in Book 4. It was not. However, it was then retroactively builded upon from that point, right?
Yes.
I think you could say this is not even a series finale for Korra's arc in Book One in the regard that it only matters the state she ended up in at the end of Book One. It's like she's still selfish but went on this journey, but is still this inherently selfish character, and she's still that way in the beginning of Book Two. So almost Book One's not even important in that regard. Yeah, I agree. Basically, this is a series finale for Korra's journey and almost nothing else.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because it's the Legend of Korra, not the Legend of all these other people.
It's not the Legend of Mako.
I almost made that post earlier today when people were complaining. I was like,
Legend
of Mako.
Nor is it the Legend of Asami. And you know, she wasn't a major character much in the last season. Although in Book One, I don't want to get in the negative too much, but people like Book of Asami.
Get in the negative.
Asami wasn't good in Book One, and Mako was good. It's actually the opposite. Asami was the best character in Book One in terms of character arc, and Mako was the worst.
Walking out of Book One, being like, why was Asami the best character?
Asami was so good in Book One. It was incredible.
Mad that she wasn't in Book
and she hasn't been as well presented. She was well presented in Book Three, but that's it. But it's still fine because she's still there, you know, like interacting with Korra. The other angle to look at this from a series finale is, should this have the biggest stakes? So I kind of touched upon this. This is the series finale. I know we said this isn't the series finale other than anything other than Korra's arc. The fact is, should this last episode of the series have the biggest stakes, the biggest action? I agree with people who say
they fought a giant robot.
They did fight a giant robot. They did fight a giant robot, but at the same time, the giant robot is not the same. Is not as big as giant spirity things battling in the Book 2 finale.
I think we can all admit that was stupid.
Stupid, but at the same time, it was bigger. Like, these are the forces of good and evil in the universe battling in giant spirit forms. So that was bigger, and those were higher stakes. And I agree. But
this
I don't think that's like...
This is a giant robot with a gun that's blowing buildings up. Yes. How can you trick it? This is very subjective.
It's subjective,
To be fair, though, Republic City, we began the series with Republic City's The Shining Beacon. Aang is so great. Look what Aang did. We have the Republic City. This is awesome. Korra discovering it. In the series, Republic City has been destroyed. It's not the same at all. It's completely different. The Spirit Vines, and I think... We talked about, you know, blow up the world. They did kind of blow up Korra's world. Korra's world and we complained about this, like, please leave Republic City. I'm so sick of Republic City. Can we get out? That's what it was. This show was Republic City, and they destroyed it. They destroyed their world. They destroyed Republic City.
They destroyed downtown.
Yeah. But,
I mean, did you see the skyline?
It was essentially,
out of the
they
sky?
Destroyed
How were they, like, that's
they,
not going to be repairable.
They destroyed Manhattan. The Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island is still functioning.
Not the final scene, but when they're on the steps and they're like the skyline's done.
Like, oh, there's look no at that skyline. Awful decimation.
Yeah, like it's so pretty. Like there's nothing. Like,
it is really pretty.
Republic
like that
City
island.
It's like when Hogwarts is burning. Like they've like everything's gone. Yeah.
So,
there were giant statues. There were giant things that fought in that movie too.
Yes.
So
yes, there was.
So I think it's still a valid. It's still
a lot of bourbon tonight.
Thank you for admitting this, Brent. It comes out. The truth comes out.
Oh, goody!
Britt joins the list of people Britt's drinking
the only
on the
one
podcast.
Who admits it though when it happens. Yeah. That's the thing.
You join the long list.
Allie just pretends.
Oh well, there's another one on the list. Okay, so I think it's still not necessarily. I don't know if it's valid or not, but we should look at it from the perspective of is the finale worse because there wasn't death, there wasn't giant world changing events. The biggest world changing event that happens is a portal being created. So one side note on that. I think it's really interesting how the big mythologically changing event that happens at the end of the series is one that only changes mythology presented within the show The Legend of Korra. The spirit portal is not something that ever existed in Avatar. And I find that really interesting. And I think that's a reason that we don't think this is as mythologically changing, because this wasn't something that existed in the original series. It's not as significant as Zhaofu existing, because that was like the direct culmination of metal being invented in Avatar. But this is
metal
just...
Bending.
This
metal
is,
was not invented in Avatar.
Metal bending. Thank you, Britt. This is not the... Well, maybe metal was invented in Avatar. I don't know. In their world,
metal
I don't
not
know.
Invented.
It could have been. Okay. But anyway, this is the... This is not something that's significant because it's something that's made up in book two, right? And it's also just, it's like, oh, there's two portals and now there's a third. Who cares, right? So it's valid.
What
I think,
if it throws off the alignment of the...
What if these are like the magnetic poles of the Avatar world and then now we're having
a third
pole?
I mean, they already don't point north, so maybe it's like a third pole and like everything's going to drift in this direction and there's going to be like more volcanic eruptions and like we're going to fly. I don't know.
But I don't know. So like,
talking, like Dylan.
Anyway, the
there's some science in there somewhere. That hashtag, the magnetic poles are important. They could affect the seasons.
Hashtag bourbon Brit. That's
your yeah. Weather is affected by magnetic poles.
Make it
poles.
Happen.
That's the new hashtag.
That's okay. The hashtag that you have to send it.
Yeah, yeah. Bourbon Brit. Okay, but anyway, so I think it's valid. It's that's maybe one of the biggest criticisms like I've seen in the finale. It's like, why would, and my biggest thing, I was like, please change something giant about the world. You can. It's the series finale. But now that it's happened, I'm like, you know, this was fine. This was fine how it was. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. Mel, Ben, any comments on this?
On whether I wanted a world-changing event?
Do you think the lack of stakes in the finale were negative, were ultimately negative?
Well, not that depends really. On what you mean by lack of stakes.
And,
I mean, there's
nobody
a lot
dying,
of
not nobody, giant action,
okay,
no
so
world-changing
yeah,
events,
that,
any of that.
Yeah, it sucks that nobody died. It especially sucks that they made that cliffhanger and then everyone got out fine.
Yeah.
Except for Batar, but he was fine.
He was just fine.
He didn't
so
die.
I do think the lack of stakes in that regard does kind of suck a bit. I don't think I needed some like giant hole in the world to blow up or anything. I'm fine with the spirit portal instance. I would have rather stakes in the human realm than plot stakes. So yeah, I'm annoyed that, and it's awful to say, but I'm annoyed that no one died or at least got very seriously injured, because that's one thing I loved about the ending of book three, is that, you know, there was huge stakes, and those huge stakes, it was blew up, and at the end of that season, Korra was in a wheelchair, and it was pretty rough. So,
Ben, do you think the lack of stakes were a problem?
No, I mean, if you look at this as a series finale, then that's not good because it doesn't wrap up, you know, our previous seasons. But as you pointed out, it's not really fair to look at it that way because these were in many ways very contained stories.
Yeah.
So I don't think the lack of big stakes, you know, people not dying and stuff, that didn't hurt it.
Yeah. Like going into it, I was like, I want people dying and I want world changing events. And I'm still a little disappointed those didn't happen. But like what we got was just so executed perfectly and so good on its own. It's like, I don't think that really was a negative.
Well, it's like people said, like Mako should have died. Well, he was willing to sacrifice himself, and for me, that's enough.
Yeah, I think there's yeah.
What would have been the point of him dying at the end?
Other than to like solidify the sacrifice that he made.
Yeah,
that would have been
make it
right?
An actual sacrifice.
But at the same time, he still made the sacrifice, whether or not the lightning hitting him directly in the chest killed him or not, which it should have. But like scientifically, but
I think the willingness to make the sacrifice is enough.
I think that's the important
part.
Can we
talk about how if it was zapped off his arm, would have just burnt off? Can we just talk about like he's not redirecting it?
Do you want to talk about it?
Why did he redirect the lightning? That's true.
I mean, he's redirecting it behind him, because I watched this the other day and I was like, is it being redirected behind him?
No, it just hits him.
He's being
right?
Zapped. It's like zapped off his shirt.
It just hits him,
exiting
I think.
His body. Which means he should be burned. Because,
he should be burned.
Lightning is hot.
Like it is. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it would be really, really hot in here, lately in that room. Like I don't know how the guards withstood that much lightning, because that close, because lightning is hot.
Yeah, true. That's
is
probably
it?
Problematic.
It's hot on the surface of the sun, so that's just, you know, zapping around in a small room. Which I guess you could argue wouldn't be
that
ridiculous, because if you've ever seen like those giant Tesla coils they have in like those little kids' museums that you go to and like elementary school?
No one's seen that, Britt.
No one see that? Okay. And there's like it's zapping off the ceiling, but this is like they made it look like giant lightning bolts and it's really close. And it's like going into like these little, I wish you guys could see the hand gesture I make, the little coily things in the ceiling. That's not very accurate, because they would just go anywhere that there's metal around, and there was plenty. And platinum may not collect metal that well, but people who are made of water mostly connect water very well. So they would all be shocked. In fact, Bolin probably would have gotten shocked as he pulls Mako out of the room.
So basically everyone should be dead.
Yes, everyone should be dead. That was your advice. I mean, just like sprouting into two specific spots to fight the fact they're not attached.
Yes.
And there was no ground wire. Like, there were static glitches everywhere. Oh, whatever.
So basically, the conclusion we've reached here is Avatar hangs science, and that's just how it is.
That's just how it
is. Also, so, yes, I really doubt they could make a movable robot.
I found you
anyways.
A poem.
What
poem? The red, violets are blue, you are that mineral, and I'm
No, this doesn't make sense to people. Okay. Anyway.
Anyway,
I just learned what that meme is about yesterday, so that's the context of this. And
don't
it's a dumb
under
meme.
A rock.
But, okay, so...
That mineral was under a rock?
And Allie was... Mel made a mineral joke. I was like, I missed the mineral joke. What?
Thank
last
you,
night, that happened last night after the podcast. Okay, anyway. So I don't think from a stakes perspective, like, I would urge you to try to view it, like, just to, like, let that leave your mind, because it's, like, better, and I don't think they need that by six. Okay, here's a different perspective, though.
What?
Functioning as a series finale. How about as a series finale, is it concluding everyone's arc? So, we've kind of talked about Korra, Bull and Mako. Asami didn't have much of an arc the entire time except related to Korra, although it brought back her father, and that was really good.
Yes.
And then they concluded that well. But how about in terms of, like, more minor characters? I've seen a lot of grievances, like, in terms of who we see at the wedding, right? So I think it's really interesting because who we see at the wedding featured prominently are the characters who were featured prominently in Book 4. So, like, this really, in my mind, says, oh, this really is just a season finale, not a series finale, and that's really what it should be. Because, you know, the most glaring thing is that... we don't see Jenora do anything. We see one shot of her, and we don't see her do anything, and we don't see her dance with Kai. And if this were, like, a true series finale, like, this is such an obvious thing to have happen.
It would have been the
parade of characters. Yeah, this is, first of all, parade of characters, even though you have Tano randomly appearing. Also, by the way, beside Tano are the two police officers from Book 2.
And Howl.
Someone said Hesuk.
Was it Howl?
Hesuk was there. That was his name.
I was going to say, is Howl at the wedding here to, like, create a love triangle?
Apparently Hesuk, but I don't remember what he looks like.
Yeah,
so Hesuk
was
know.
There. Like,
okay.
My friend,
I didn't see him.
Everyone's
saying he's there, so.
Remembered him.
In the band. So,
he was there.
We were like, oh, what's the gag?
He was in the
be?
Band.
What's the gag of them returning characters going to be? Is it remembrances? No. Is it the evacuation? No.
Remember
it's this band. That's what it
evil?
Is. Yeah.
She was with the Equalists.
Yeah, well, she was.
No, but I mean consciously?
True. Well, she was originally plot-wise, but so, like...
And then...
So, like, okay, so Iki dancing with Wanda was really nice, and that's nice to wrap
hilarious.
Up that character. That's one of my favorite moments, actually, the entire
so
thing. Also, Iki's just so cute, and just dancing. Anyway.
Like, when Iki caught Jenora, I was like, Sister Bamps.
Well, that was a good moment, too, but, so, not having Jenora be talk in the finale and not having her do anything in the wedding, right? So this is a character who's a major character in Books 2 and 3, but was not a major character in Book 4. So I can understand her not doing anything relative to Book 4.
Mm-hmm.
But... Like, if you want to look at this as, this isn't satisfying as a series finale in the regard that Jenora doesn't do anything and there's no Jenora and Kai. And, you know, that kind of sucks. And I'm, as someone who's, Jenora is my favorite character and this was always was and always will be, like, that's not, it's not very pleasant for me. And it sucks that she's not there and she's not really doing anything. But at the same time, she wasn't important this season for whatever reason. I am starting to question whether Kieran and Shipka had, conflicts, but
it's possible.
I think
it just seemed odd that she didn't.
She shook her head when Mark was like, "Is she there?" And she just like.
It seems really, really conspicuous that she didn't talk at all in the finale, right?
Yeah,
like, she didn't say anything.
It's possible. It's possible they were recording Matt, but they're not recording Mad Men this whole time, right? Like, she could have done ADR on her. I don't know.
Maybe she just is like, no, I don't want to make any more episodes. I have the flu.
I mean, I did hear one rumor that she wasn't into Korra, but I don't want to, like, spread rumors like that. I don't know. Anyway, but, like, it's really, I do wonder if there's outside influence on Jenora and, like, not being prominent at all in the finale, because she was, like, a very major character in Books 2, and the end of Book 2, and all of Book 3, and I don't know. It sucks. I wish she did stuff. At the same time, it doesn't detract from what we did see, because all of what we did see was great. I'd also, it's not going to, like, make the finale worse because we didn't see her, because, again, she wasn't really doing anything in Book 4 to begin with. I would absolutely love a comic or some form of story after with Jenora and the Airbenders, continuing specifically Jenora.
I could literally just do an entire comic book
about
the Airbenders.
Yes. I would also love to write that, but, like, yes. I might do a fan fiction on that, but, like...
Dylan writes 300-word fan fiction.
Yeah.
Accurate. In first person?
They should, they should.
Single spaced, and he indents his paragraphs.
Yeah. They should commission me to do the Jenora comic books, yeah. Yeah, Scrooge and Yang. Yeah.
Who? What?
Me, that's who. Obviously, the big one we're going to see is, we want to see is Korra and Asami after, right? And their trip to the
Spirit
World.
What comics? What are you talking about?
There's Avatar comics. So the potential of Korra comics.
Oh, okay. So when people were talking about comics, they were talking about them so assuredly that I thought there was something I missed.
No, there's as of now, there's absolutely nothing. But like, it's theoretically possible, you know.
Mm.
So
I sort of don't want to see any Korra comics, though.
Yeah.
As long as they're not about Korra. Like, if they could do, like,
I want to see Korra and Asami.
I mean, if we're going to have Korra comics, they need to be
the legend of everyone else besides Korra.
I guess what I'm afraid is if they do a comic, could the writer possibly undo what we saw in the finale, make it a friendship, and then...
Well, no, okay. Obviously, if we're doing it, it needs to be full-on romance. Like,
it needs to be, like, full-on Korra.
You get what I'm saying. I'm just afraid they would...
I did have that fear as well when people were talking about comic books. So I was like, well, what if the comic book...
Yeah, it's like, is Nick really going to commission a queer romance comic book, right? Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah,
that's why I don't want it. I need.
Although on the flip side of that, they probably would get away with a lot more in a comic book form than they would.
You know what? If there was going to be a sequel, my ideal sequel series as a like television show to Korra would be like Jenora as the main character, focusing on the new Airbenders, and then like major side characters are Korra and Asami as like a couple, and like them giving like the Airbenders, helping the Airbenders at various points. Right.
This was like what you wanted for book four.
This is what I wanted for book four.
It's moving away from Korra. It's going to be a lot about Jenora. Book four.
No, now I just want this as a new series. Okay.
I think Dylan is just really likes Jenora. I think that's all I can take away from this.
You
is Dylan likes Jenora.
You think? Are you just now figuring this out?
Also, I think the Airbender plotline is just super.
I don't know. It's really
unclear.
Right?
Like, it's just really unclear. Yeah. Is that still a thing we're going to do? Really unclear.
Dylan. Okay. Dylan. Is Jenora your favorite character?
Yes, I said so too. Although, you know, one of the reasons
Do you like her more than Katara?
Yes. Not as much as I know. It goes one Aang, two Jenora, three Katara. We've gotten into this on Tumblr with people. But anyway.
Dylan FTSW is not a we statement. It's not like you're email us at dylan@ftsw.whatever.
You're still bitter that our email was me at Tumblr.
Yes.
Still. Jeez. Wow, that was
it's
a knock
been
on
84
that.
Years.
It's been 84 years. Yeah, so... So I'm obviously not happy with that, and I understand other people not being happy with Lack of Jenora, and apply this to your favorite side character, Kai, as well. Opal was not a focus in the finale, but I think she had such a... Britt was not there, but she had such a strong arc throughout the rest of the season. Her, along with Bolin, was concluded before the finale started, right?
Well, I'm just happy there was giant DNA in the sky. I feel like that was there just for me.
Just for me.
Mike and Bragg was like, yes.
Like,
she didn't see us girl, for yeah. using her in the, as a character, so we're just gonna
so
biology.
I think it's an interesting how they like mapped out season book four. Like they just wanted to end certain plot threads before the finale started, so they could just focus on the finale. I think that's why the pacing was so good of the finale. Why like
yes.
it was yeah
because like, so much was already resolved.
They didn't have to do that much. Yeah,
so, that's great. I'm happy.
But anyway, so like as a conclusion to the series finale discussion, it's like yes, Jenora wasn't their cousin or whatever, but the rest of it, like the major elements were there as the series finale, and really this is just a season finale, and it was an incredibly satisfying season finale at that, and where the show ultimately ends up, I think the epilogue was just incredibly emotionally satisfying.
It was beautiful. Are we talking? Does the epilogue include just the Korra Asami scenes, or is it also
no? The entire everything from the wedding onwards.
Okay, because that wedding was like my whole life in a basket. I could have died happy after that wedding.
Your whole life in a basket. Yes.
You know what? I'm drunk.
The truth continues to come out. No.
Hashtag Bourbon Britney.
Hashtag
Bourbon Brit.
Bourbon Brit. Yes.
Brit, what's your Tumblr password?
What?
No,
she's not that. She's not that drunk. Okay, almost. Speaking of Tumblr passwords, where's my Zuki fic, Mel?
Listen, a lot has happened in the past. There was a big big swing out of left field that
there
I
was.
Have to cover first.
There was, but
so,
you know, Ezekiel.
Which I already have, and I almost have 100. Which, by the way, Dylan, that post... Actually, wait, never mind. I'm not going to talk
tell
about
me. No, tell me. What?
Which anyway, post?
No post, nothing. Forget. Never mind. Forget I said anything.
Okay.
Sure.
You
made posts. Okay.
I need to throw that stuff out there.
Anyway, in conclusion, I think this does work as a series finale. It's not really a series finale, but I think the epilogue is satisfying as a series finale, even if, you know, certain, specifically Jinori not there, it's still fine. It still really works as a series finale. All the characters get there. Oh, I see. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So all the Kenora's secret discussions on chat that you
yes.
all didn't get to hear about.
Super secret.
Super secret. I'm mad about it, by the way.
Just because I had the best idea, and I had one idea, and it was the best idea. It doesn't matter. Okay, anyway. I think
and
it really, it does really work in the epilogue. I think it really hits the important parts. I think it's not a conclusion to book one. Only Korra's character arc is relevant. Yes, book two's finale is bigger, but who cares? It's not a conclusion to that other than Korra's character arc. The end with that. So I really don't think I would really, really implore you to try to watch this without worrying about that
just
stuff.
Just be happy.
This gorgeous, gorgeous ending to this finale.
They had a Pinterest wedding, and there were fireworks, and they were married by Bo.
They had a
Poppy.
Pinterest. They had a Pinterest wedding.
Pinterest wedding.
Define Pinterest wedding.
Brit's
we're
wedding.
All such plebeians.
First of all, no one says the full word.
Yeah, you say
weirdo. Second of all. You're the only one who posts Pinterest blogs in chat,
yeah.
Pinterest whatever in chat. No one actually knows what Pinterest
none of us
is.
Understand Pinterest. It's just
I see. Okay, so
I think pins are involved.
What did I? What was I even just saying? Anyway,
boards?
Seriously, guys, people who are stuck up on this not being as epic as the series finale, just like I want you to feel what I'm feeling, right? Like
be happy.
We both love this.
Dylan can bottle his emotions.
Dear person, we both love this. This applies to many, many people. Dear person, we both love this series incredibly. Please try to enjoy this finale and get past your roadblocks as much as enjoy it as much as we do, because it really is that good if you get past these faults.
The dude who was the messenger for Tarlok was also in the band.
Was he?
What?
Yeah, he's playing the tuba.
I gotta load this up.
I'm looking at a picture of it right now.
So great.
The one voiced by D.
Voiced by D. Okay, let's get this, we need to analyze this band. Okay, so I have the band up. So, we have the two police officers, we have Tano. I don't know if that is the what's their name.
Asuk.
It's the apparently it's Asuk. Apparently it's the council page. There you go. That's the name of the character. And there's two other people, so I don't know.
Do you think these people are just like all disgruntled side characters who just met up in a bar one night and were like, "Let's start a band, guys"?
Feathered Hat Guy was in the beginning of 409, though.
Well, I am aware of that.
So he doesn't need to come back. I don't know who these two other people are, though. Maybe one of them is Howell. I don't know. We need this is the thing you need to make a post on. Explain who everyone is.
Please
okay.
explain, yes.
Yeah.
Out of everything, we need to know more about this band.
Yes, well, yeah, I don't know. Okay, so what haven't we talked about yet? So one last thing to talk about, or I don't know, last, we might get another stuff, but let's talk about how good of a villain Kavir is. We kind of already talked about this, but so we want to rank the four major Korra villains, right? Amon... Shudders, what's his face? What's his face from book two?
Tarlok. Someone on Tumblr asked me to rank the villains once and I forgot Uno.
<That's>
An hour after I made the post or responded, I was like, oh, Unalaq, right, because I had Vatu, I just forgot.
Amon, Unalaq, Zaheer, and Kuvira.
We need to rank Vatu. Vatu needs to be in the ranking.
No, Vatu's number one.
Yes.
Vatu would be first if we ranked
him. Yeah,
Vatu's
number one always.
Okay, Vatu's number one. Other than that, Mel, rank these four.
Oh, okay.
We're not even going to talk about
I'm going to do this in ascending order.
Okay.
They're taken off like that DNA strand.
Yes.
I'm going to say my least... favorite villain
obviously.
Is Unalaq.
Obviously.
That's not even a question. number two is Amon. Sorry, guys. By number two, I don't mean number two. I mean number three, I guess. Number two is Zaheer. Number one is Kuvira.
I'm with Mel. My rankings.
That's the same. Ben, where are you on this?
Let's do that list, but let's switch Zaheer and Kuvira.
And Britt, where are you on this?
Okay. I think Kuvira was done better, but I appreciate Zaheer more.
That's not a definitive answer.
It is. I feel like Zaheer more, but
I think
like,
she's saying
Kuvira
the same thing
isn't...
as Ben, basically.
So is
basically, I appreciate him.
Is Zaheer number
like
one
more.
For you?
He's more interesting to me, but Kuvira as like a villain, I think her arc was executed better. Like Zaheer
okay,
at the end,
so...
she actually had an arc.
Yeah, she actually Zaheer at the end just was kind of diminished.
Zaheer was
a crazy
ideology.
Man. He
was
never.
Was
he never.
Person.
Yeah, he was a theology, but they never. They did a little bit acknowledge him as a person with his relationship with Khalid.
I think,
but
I think
you know that was never the end point.
The things he did, not who he was.
Yeah, they didn't focus on who he was, and they diminished him to an ideology, and they made him seem crazy.
Okay.
When at certain points in the story, they had made his ideology almost seem legitimate, but
objection.
Actually legitimate.
Okay,
like he's
so,
an extremist, but they
objection. No, so by the way,
overrule.
Play Phoenix right. So okay, Zaheer 1, Kuvira 2. Amon 3, and who, there's no fourth. So, doesn't mean anything.
Who's the fourth of me?
Okay, so let me defend this. Okay, so let's compare Zaheer and Kuvira. So my thing with the Kuvira is I don't think she came together like as incredibly well as like Mel and Delaney think. I think it's a lot of personal preference. I think certainly her ending was better than Zaheer's. I think that's like no question, because Zaheer was completely diminished at the end. But, you know what's really interesting is, you know what I think elevates Zaheer over Kuvira definitively is Zaheer's appearance in book 4. I think if you just take book 3 Zaheer, maybe Kuvira's better. But the fact that this character comes back and has this more added complexity level to him, and the fact that his ideologies are confirmed with his just willingness to help Korra because of this dictator taking over the Earth Kingdom... that just does so much to me. I love his character in 409, and it was just so well done. I think overall, just Zaheer is just absurdly interesting from basic concepts.
Agree on something.
I know, bro. High five, Brit. High five, Bourbon Brit. From concept of just as this twisted airbender ideology into execution. With I think Henry Rollins did a great job with although not as good as probably as Zelda Williams with Kuvira, but it's just the execution of his role in the story, his gaining of I think it's like, oh, Zaheer's not a character. Oh well, you know, the first thing I'd point to is his romance with Pali, and then his subsequent letting go.
Well, that's
go.
What's so interesting. It's so similar to Kuvira, because Pili died. Yeah, granted, it wasn't Zaheer's fault, but then Kuvira was like tried to murder Batar.
Yeah, so they have similar things here, but
between like willingly letting them die and have their like die in a fight that wasn't your fault, like. I guess the death is the same.
This is almost. The thing that I would point to for, like, who's the better person, Zaheer or Kuvira? I think it's pretty clearly Zaheer is a better person, and I would point
to... But
that
to, doesn't necessarily make them a better character.
No, I know. I agree, but I point to the fact that, like, Kuvira, like, tried to kill her own
the only person who probably really loved her.
The only person she cared about. And then Zaheer just genuinely has this connection.
Now that's a breakup.
But anyway.
That's my favorite.
My girlfriend tried to blow me up. That's rough, buddy.
That's rough, buddy. Yeah. So to me, that's like point one of Zaheer's character. Also, is just his interactions with the rest of his Red Lotus crew. His ideology presentation in the stakeout was absurdly good. His subsequent presentation in 409 was incredibly good. Beyond the Wilds, there you go. That's the name of that episode. And I just thought he was more intriguing. His appearance in 305, his interactions with Iki and Kaya, that creepiness, and then that absurdly great fight with Kaya. Which is still one of my top five fights of the series. I know they mangled him at the end, and I know his ultimate motivations weren't as interesting as we thought. But to me, he's still just the paramount villain. He was just so good in book 3. And I don't think you guys are going to argue that he wasn't that good, but I think you guys just have a higher opinion of Kuvira than me, I guess.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with like his personal preference. Like, I am not that into an. He's just an entirely ideological villain, and it's like. Like it was interesting, but then by the end of it, I was like, okay, I'm kind of tired of this. I don't really care anymore. Well, it's not as interesting.
Given him more.
Yeah, like Kuvira. Like for me, it's because Kuvira. Like especially with the finale, is like we're seeing like Kuvira's motivations as like a person, and like what's like her immaturity, and like the cracks in her armor, and like the weakness of her character and of her person. And then with Zaheer, it's like, okay, whatever. Like, you're just all Zaheer is this ideology.
They never gave him. They didn't give him much of a.
And yes, the Pili thing was great because I mean I ship Pili and Zaheer hardcore. Like, so that's like, a big deal.
So again, I would say I like literally just.
I wish they
had
given more of him backstory with the other. The other four characters, like how they became.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would have loved some Red Solar Spectre. But again, I don't think Zaheer is just ideology. I think the biggest difference, as I said, is interactions with the Red Lotus and Pili. I think counters that pretty easily. But I think the biggest difference between the two is the fact that Zaheer is very ideologically based. His character is obsessed with this ideology. And Kuvira doesn't really have this one, right? Like, she's not even presented with an ideology at all. It's just, power! I need more power! Right? That's her whole thing. That's a reference to her line in.
Yeah, but I think the interesting thing about that is she doesn't mean that in, like, oh, yes, risk board, power, I need power. It's a vulnerability thing, and I think that's interesting. I mean, I do think it's a good way to justify, like, you know, that type of villain, because it's like so done to death and cliche and so shallow, and you've got this villain who just wants to be powerful for no, seemingly no reason. The thing here is that what Korra said was really, really hit the nail on the head, is that she doesn't like being vulnerable in the slightest, which is why I think she shoves Korra out of the way like 5 times when she wakes up and she's like, ah, it's you again, pulling me out of
you
rubble.
Again.
And then,
you
like,
again.
And then she like pushes her out of the way and
you again.
Away and hey, shut up. And I think that really justifies a lot of her character stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it is for this justification.
Okay, so here's my thing with Kuvira. So I think in the absence, so Zaheer, similar to Kuvira, didn't have that much backstory. But for Zaheer, that's not as important because he is very ideologically driven. Kuvira didn't have that, so I think her backstory and her like moments in the finale of character moments are like much more crucial. And the thing that makes it like okay, so pause. That Kuvira is a very.
Did you say
Zaheer? Zaheer. I think I said that multiple times this podcast. Kuvira.
Sorry, there was
hashtag bourbon Brits. Kuvira is
bourbon Brit.
Kuvira is a very appealing villain to me on the level that she is female and young, and it's the first female villain we've had in Korra, and she's pretty and dominating and really appealing to me. But like other than that, I think the reason Kuvira falls up short is that Kuvira falls up. To me, Kuvira comes up short in that her backstory, which is presented solely in the episode 405, I believe, is not enough. And
I didn't see in any of her life with Sue.
Like, it's like, oh, she was like a daughter to me. And that's it. That's all we got. I love the fan art of it, of like Kuvira coming into Sue's office and stuff like that. And that, but that's not what the show says. Like, that's like assuming things. And all we get is Kuvira is like a daughter to me. What does that mean? I don't know. Book 4 doesn't tell us. Like, there wasn't enough there, and I don't think her interactions with Korra in the end were enough. Like, I think they were good, and I think they were excellent, like, in terms of how her and Korra relate. But just for her character, like, it didn't ultimately culminate in, like, a super cathartic moment for just Kuvira's character arc.
Like the counter to that, though, is that, like, we're putting all this basis on all Zaheer was. He was just an ideology and, like, a real person.
Again, he's not known himself. Stop with the just
is.
An ideology. I've countered
that
multiple times.
Like, oh, my God.
Multiple times. Yes.
No, your main points are like, okay, Pili and like his, we needed more though. We needed more interactions with Pili and with the Fred Lowe's. We said that like 2 minutes ago. And like, so Kuvira, like, it's the same, like your issues with Kuvira are like the same issues with Zaheer.
So what I said on this was, yes, both of them, it's like similar to Kuvira, Zaheer also has a lacking backstory, but what makes up for it is his focus on his ideology. And Kuvira lacks
this focus. To me,
that's a weakness
for a character.
Like, well, it's like, I'm just, I like wonder what it replaces, it's replaced with for Kuvira, you know? Like, what does she have? Like, what is her? what is her substantial thing of her as a villain? She's kind of just there for me a lot of the season.
That she's Korra. That's the thing. And maybe that's not a good enough argument because it still relies on Korra, but then again, Zaheer, not to beat a dead horse, but Zaheer's character does rely heavily on the fact that this is what he thinks ideologically, and that's what he does, and the airbenders. Kuvira's big pull for Kuvira as a villain is that she is book one Korra, who's a lot meaner. And that's the thing is like, you know, you had to come, that she, you know, minus the technology, minus the giant robot, handles things the way Korra in book one would have handled them. And
that's the interesting pull there for Kuvira as a villain in terms of what you're talking about.
I think
and what, and what she forces the other characters to do.
Yes.
Okay, expand on that.
Like, Zaheer, yes, Zaheer did terrible things to Korra. Like, that was the Red Lotus. They did terrible things to the world and to Korra. Obviously, Kuvira is taking over the Earth Kingdom and all this, but, like, Kuvira forces all the characters...
That's pretty bad.
Like, Kuvira forces all of the characters to, like, I mean, to change. Like, Korra has to adapt to fight Kuvira, and Bolin, like, Kuvira is why Bolin changes, like, and Opal. Like, Kuvira is the center of, like, how, why all these characters have to change and develop. Like, Kuvira is the center of it. She, all of her actions are causing all of these things. Zaheer,
she's
like
a catalyst for plot.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. To me, what that argument is that Zaheer, Kuvira functions better within her season as a villain in terms of relating to other characters and stuff. And I agree with that. But I don't think that makes her like a better villain. If that makes sense.
Well, that's fine. And we're just not going to agree.
Well, so
to me,
the points. I mean, countering. Going back to discuss things on this, I think Mel was talking about, I don't remember. But so Kuvira is very focused upon her. Mel said the most interesting thing is how she's related to Korra. And that really only comes up, I guess, twice in the season. And the first time is that when her face is replaced by a dark avatar, Korra. And I think that is presented in that episode more as a Korra's mental state thing rather than a how the two interact and how they're similar, you know. I think ultimately we go into the season, it's like, oh, Kuvira is this very similar villain to person to Korra. But that's because, like, Mike and Brent said that in interviews. I think it's interesting that they said that, and then it's presented in the finale, like, so explicitly. But then we just get it in this one line in the finale, you know. So to me, that aspect is not very well fleshed out because it's not focused upon more than a few seconds. Same with her backstory, her interactions with Sue. I think her interactions with Sue are meant to be very meaningful. But I don't think they're presented, they're based upon enough substantial elements in the season. The things to me that are successful.
And like, even at the end, when Sue's like taking her away, like this child, she's known this girl since she was a child. She lived in her home. She took her in, but like she doesn't react like this is her daughter who's done really terrible things, which I feel like that would be something Sue would do, would be like.
Yeah, and it then and like also during her
I think
fight.
Did I mention that in my thoughts that I sent in that I was
possibly
I think I mentioned it in the live podcast vaguely.
Yeah,
I
but
was
I'll,
disappointed that Sue didn't say no. These is the things you have done to your family.
Yeah,
Sue was very detached from it. Also during her fight with Kuvira in episode 10. So I think that eventually their dynamic, I guess that was well done in their interactions in the current, but not based upon enough substantial. What I think was well done with Kuvira was her dynamic with Batar. I think that was extremely well presented throughout the season.
I
think that was a good strength, but I think that was also a strength of Zaheer. So I guess I don't really care who's a better villain. It's whatever. But I think this is getting into maybe one reason why, because to me, books 3 and 4, and this is something maybe we discussed before Mel and Brick got on, books 3 and 4 very similar in quality in terms of episodes. Book four has one less incredible episode than book 3. However, book 4 also has the 2 best episodes of the series. So which one is better? One reason you could say that book 3 is better is because it doesn't have this like non-developed, like its villain was more prominent, its villain was more established within what it was trying to present. Like, yes, Zaheer also didn't have his backstory, and I've maybe said this like multiple times, but it wasn't as important to him. What was more important is that we got this entire third act of the stakeout where he presented his ideology in that, and that was like a solid foundation. We didn't really have an equivalent.
I mean, I will say the reason I rank book 4 above book 3 is because Kuvira is a better villain to me than Zaheer.
Yeah, and I don't know if it would like. I don't think it's maybe fair to make it boil down to that, but it is an interesting.
Well, I mean, it doesn't. I mean, that's not the only reason. But I'm saying that is a definite reason.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to also to because they're just very similar in quality the seasons as we talked about earlier. So like to me, it's like episode 9 of book 3. We have this entire last act of the episode focusing on Zaheer, and then it's like, oh, the equivalent of that in book 4 is. Oh, well, it's Zaheer again. It's not Kuvira. It's actually just Zaheer again. We're focusing on Zaheer. So it's like, I just don't think Kuvira had enough time really to develop into this, this incredible force that Zaheer was, I think. Also, another factor in that is that there's one less episode that season, right? In book 4. And so it's like, not only was Zaheer replaced Kuvira in one episode in book 4 from book 3, there's also just one less episode because of the the plot thing. So I think there's less time for her also to develop into this thing. But I think you could definitely make an argument that in the end, I would say that, like, just based on the finale, like, I think that's certainly, even just based on the finale, it's valid to say Kavira's better because of just, it's just still so disappointing in book three finale how bad they treated Zaheer, right?
Yeah. So mad.
Still very disappointing.
Forever angry.
Maybe this is, I do think the problems that I have with the lack of presentation of Kavira is one reason why the middle of book three, maybe it's like pretty stagnant and like, or book four is pretty stagnant and it's like book four as a whole isn't.
Because we didn't even see Kavira when she was like, when we first got introduced to Sue.
If she was raised like a daughter.
She was there in the background.
I just wonder how much more effective it would have been if like, rather, like, it's like they knew she was going to be the thing, so they worked her, it's like maybe they worked her back in during storyboarding rather than writing, but if they knew during writing that she was going to be the villain and she was like this character rather than in Enter the Void, I'm Kavira.
And the music, and you're like, yep, she's evil.
It's like, yep, she's evil. It's like, oh, this is this character we know, and now she did this during the 3 years we were gone, this side character that we know has elevated into the main villain. That would be really cool.
Yeah.
But they didn't really do that. So I think that that's not really a criticism. That's just maybe a missed opportunity, you know?
Yeah. I mean, did they know what they were going to do for book four at the beginning of in book three?
Well, they have,
how much have they written of that?
Right. You know? So I think what probably happened was they hadn't figured out in terms of writing that Kavira would be the villain of book four, but they were able to go back in terms of animation and storyboarding to add in the Kavira references into book three. Yeah. That'd be my assumption.
Yes, I agree.
Anyway, I think we've discussed this to death, kind of, this topic.
Okay, let's move
overall, on. Though, I'd say, you know, Kavira, very good villain in book four. Better than I thought that she would be when, after book three, it was like, oh, obviously she's going to be the main villain because of this intro. Like that, and I was like, that wasn't very promising, given her introduction. Yep. I will say, one of the most interesting dynamics story-wise of her is the fact that, like, she's, like, already in power after a time skip. Yeah. Again, I just want to go back to one of the things this season, just how interestingly that time skip was handled. Like, Kavira's already in power, and we're dealing with the ramifications of it all season, and even at the end, we deal with the ramifications of it. It's like, you weren't there, right? That's really interesting.
Very interesting, yes.
Yeah.
Time skips.
Deep wisdom from Bourbon Brit, yes. All right.
Bourbon Brit.
Okay, so what else do we want to talk about? So I guess, where are we... Let's to wrap things up, where are we going to, where are we now with book four, with the finale? I will say personally, it's like, began to dawn on me that there are no more episodes of the show. And it's like,
that's going to happen in season five. Oh, wait, there is.
Oh, wait, no.
Yeah. I'm not going to get an email Sunday night.
I mean, you might.
Get bugged about it for 3 days.
You might.
Never again.
I might just be like, no, respond to this email, and then you...
Bother.
Yeah. But it's like no, there's no more...
Get to get up at early on Friday.
I know, no more early on Fridays, that's fine.
Talk about
never got up early
it's like,
on Friday
it's like where we are...
I saw the episodes after all of you.
Sigh. Where we are now is like... It's like I'm starting to transition to this evaluation mode instead of this, like, wait for the next episode one. And it's this really sad. It's like what happened with Avatar. And,
I remember listening to this podcast.
Like, oh, we're looking back on it. And
you're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, and I don't know. It's like I'm very happy where the series ended up, especially just, I mean, we've talked about it to death, but just the emotional impact of the epilogue, from a societal impact, from a no reservations watching the show anymore. And it's just ended in such a beautiful place. And I'm just so happy with how the finale turned out. It was so much better than what I thought it was going to be the end of the finale. The series was so much better than what I thought it was going to be going into it. I first hear from Jake that there's going to be a series for Mike and Brian. And we, like, we start talking about it. But one thing we learn early on is that they're not bringing the writers back. And we're both very, very skeptical of this decision. Because through, you know, like, maybe me and Jake have a different perspective on this throughout Avatar, because we have this, whether you know or not, DF has this, had this in production, this contact during the times of Avatar, and we kind of saw production from a different standpoint, and one of those things was that, you know, maybe Mike and Brian aren't the story creative forces that we thought they were throughout Avatar. like a lot of people are like, oh, this is Mike and Brian's series. Maybe I kind of saw it as, oh, this was, you know, Aaron and the writers series in addition to these wonderful showrunners. And it's like, oh, we're not bringing this creative force back in. And I was like, you know, it's cool that we're going to get another Avatar series, but with no Aaron E. Haas and no writers, I don't see how this could be anything like Avatar was. And to a certain extent, it wasn't, but at the same time, book one kind of exceeded expectations.
It did exceed expectations.
It was just much, it was like a genuinely good TV. It was a really nice miniseries arc. And Sam says hello, by the way, so.
Oh, right.
But it was like, it was better than we thought. It was at the same time, it didn't like elevate into incredible television. Amon was great. It ended kind of down. Then we had this incredibly long wait to book two. It's like, yes, we're still fans of the show, but we weren't like incredibly active during the off season. It wasn't like, this was the only thing entertainment wise we thought about. It was just kind of this secondary thing. And then book two starts and it's not great. And there's the worst animation and, these episodes aren't as good for a while. I watch as several of my friends who kept up with it during book one start book two and then stop watching. It's pretty sad. And, you know, and then we keep going. Obviously, we're incredible fans of Mike and Brian's show. And then, you know, it starts to get better. I fall in love with the new spiritual age, and it completely rejuvenates my love for Korra. Maybe begins my true love for the show. We get into the finale. It's disappointing. We have a less long wait. And then the leak happens for book three, as I talked about earlier this podcast. These episodes are just like we watched the episodes in Spanish. They were so good, and it turns out that three of the four of those from the leak were even three of the four worst ones of the season. The season, when we watch it in English full, the full complete is like even better than that. And book three is just one of the greatest things ever.
In Espanol,
it like happens very fast. It happens this summer. And it just completely just dominates my entertainment life, and it turns into my main hobby. And just one of the best seasons of television I've ever seen. It's so astounding how it could have been, how it could rival and even maybe surpass Avatar in book three. Not that book two didn't do that, because I thought the end of book two really did do that as well. And book one was also good as well. And then the short wait, we get right into book four. We have this, it was completely during the semester this year, but it was just one episode at a time. And we have this season that kind of seems like it's taking a while and not necessarily elevating to heights, but eventually culminates with several incredible episodes. Has Korra alone at the beginning, which was one of the best things I've ever seen. And then just ends with something we've been anticipating the entire time. Whether or not it was incredibly developed so much, something that we all were completely in love with. And it was just so satisfying to see, satisfying on a societal, social level, and I'm still on this incredible high from the end of the series. This will definitely be one of the most significant series of my lifetime. This and Avatar are the two, and it will be remembered certainly for us forever as this just one of the best animated series of all time, one of the best television series of all time that I've seen. You could make an argument that it is the best. I mean, these last two seasons were so incredible. And this turned into kind of like this long rant about this. But like, this is the end, right?
Dylan's sympathy for all tour comes to an end.
Dylan's positivity for all tour. Yeah, I mean, I gave every episode this season over an 8 out of 10. Like, I've seriously liked everyone.
Like, this is like, Dylan, Mr. Cynical Pants.
Like, this, I genuinely thought this season was incredible.
He's like, I didn't really like this episode. All these things are wrong with
it. But it was still good.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's really sad it's coming to end. I'm still gonna be watching for more on it, like being on Tumblr about the show and stuff like that. We'll still be podcasting on it for a little bit. I guess this is a good time to mention the future podcast schedule again. We have like three more planned podcasts. We're gonna do a episode rankings one. We're gonna do a Korra in a societal angle, aka talk about Korrasami some more. And we're gonna do the Rift discussion, because we haven't talked about that at all. That's right. Yeah. So we'll try
that guy who didn't end up being Lynn's father.
Yeah.
So that's true. So we'll try to plan all those.
They're definitely not going to end.
It's possible this is the last podcast for
spoiler alert.
Spoiler. Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe they get together and then like break up or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's this podcast. We might not have another podcast for 2 weeks. I think looking at the schedule, it gets kind of hectic around this time. And certain people here.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah. Christmas yeah, and New Year's. Right. And certain,
Christmas is in 5 days, guys.
Just certain people here are very busy, too, I think. Like Mel said, you said you're working like every day.
So, yeah. No, actually, I got my schedule. I'm only working 2 or 3 days next week, actually.
Oh, okay. So maybe we can get one in at the end of next week. That is also around Christmas, so I don't know. But yeah. And we'll continue the podcast. I'm not going to, once we get past those three, I'm not going to like stop the podcast. It's going to be here, and it's going to be like if we're all on one night and we want to do a commentary for the last episode, like we'll do that. Or we have just like, we all rewatch it and we discuss, like we have like, oh, Kurosami discussion numbers 1 through 5. And we just every
number
week get on and discuss Kurosami or like something like that. You know,
shipping
like,
podcast.
It could just be whatever we want.
And, yes. Can we have another genetics podcast?
Oh yeah, people did want another shippings podcast. That's
Dylan's
true.
Punnett scores. There's a 32.5% chance.
I still have four outlines for Harry Potter and Avatar and four comparisons.
I don't think we're going to get to the Harry Potter ones, unfortunately.
There are still four outlines.
Shipping. That's one I'll try to do. I think
we could have a fandom podcast, talk about fan fiction and stuff again. We did that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have as much to contribute there, but yeah.
We will force Dylan into podcast.
We have to talk about my fan fiction.
Yeah, let's just have a podcast on Mel's fanfics.
Oh, I have fan fiction too. Thank you.
I mean, that's more substantial stuff to talk about. We'll have a podcast on Mel's Zuki fic whenever it comes.
Oh my god!
If
you let me host it, I'll finish the fic.
Yeah, no deal. Anyway,
wow.
Dylan's greatest fear is that one day his internet will give out and I have to host a podcast.
It almost happened one week. Like, yeah, my computer. There, then I don't know. There you go. The fandom continues. My interest in the show will live on, of course, and stuff like that. I don't know. Maybe I want to write this Jenora after the fact. What the new series fanfic? That'd be great.
Do it.
I should do that. Yes. Yeah.
Make it longer than 300 words.
Yeah.
So.
I think I'd probably break Jenora up with Kai right away, though. So that wouldn't sit well with people.
I like everyone.
If you're gonna start a new series with Jenora,
what is that Joss Whedon says? You can't always give people what they want. Sometimes you need to give them what they need.
I see all these. Yeah. One note about this. I see all these fan arts and fanfics of Jenora and Kai, and it's like I see these with Kai like holding Jenora and like Kai in this dominant romantic position. It's like.
I hate to break it to you guys, but Jenora totally wears the pants.
Jenora is like, I don't want to ship that. I want.
There is no pants. I don't think either of them wear pants. They're just kind of hanging out. And they're like, yeah, I like you. You like you too. Let's hang out, guys.
I don't care about Kai as like this, like this cool
have
boyfriend.
You met Kai?
Like,
he's not that manly.
Like, whatever. Like, I want.
He's like
Jenora should be the most.
Yeah,
prominent
yeah
one,
he's
you know?
Been acting like a 15.
Anyway, side note, but. That's I don't know what that had to do with anything. What, anyone have any thoughts on what I've rambled about for the past 20 minutes?
I literally don't.
No. I think no.
No, like where are you emotionally right now with the series? I guess that's the question.
I'm still like on like yesterday, like 24 hours straight giddy. Like I've been like every time I leave the house, I'm just thinking about Kurosami and the finale. It still hasn't hit me that it's over. Like yeah. I'm not like. And I don't know when it'll hit me, and I'll just be sad.
Well,
but,
poor
like,
Sami made everyone forget that it was over
yes,
for, like, a solid 12 hours. Like, nobody was talking about the fact that it was yeah. over. And then around, like, 8 o'clock the next morning, everyone's like, guys, it's over.
Yeah. I don't know, like, I'm just not, I don't know, like, I'm not, it hasn't hit me yet. Just, like, it didn't hit me when Avatar, like, ended. Like, it hadn't processed that it was over. So I don't know how I'll deal with that. But I'm just, I'm in a weird, happy place.
What about you, Mel?
I mean, I did start getting pretty sad today because I'm like, oh, there's no more waking up on Friday and fighting with Nick's stupid thing to watch an episode. And even back in the day, in freshman year in college, when I was like, oh, I have to wake up at 11 o'clock in the morning to watch this episode.
Yeah, that's true. Freshman year.
And all that other stuff. And,
you
know.
I mean, I don't know, it's like the show's ending at the same time, I'll still be on, fandom's still on Tumblr, I mean, I'll still be obviously around to discuss this, I mean, we're like a friend group beyond the show, I think, obviously.
Yeah. I think that's probably why
I've been to Ali's house. So.
Yeah, like, I don't know.
I think that's really, like, if I hadn't, like, found, like, the podcast and, like, talking to all of you, I think I would be, like, super just upset and done,
Because, like, I haven't, like, I don't really, I mean, now I do, now that I'm at college, but, like, I didn't have anyone to talk to about it. Like, my family doesn't really care. Like, I don't have friends who care.
You so, like, can't I mourn effectively. More upset. You're just, like, stuck in Venice over this, yeah. like, a giant hole in your life.
Yeah.
Like, I think it would be on Cloud Nine forever. Like, I
that's
can't
the
see
thing
it.
Is that sucks, is because it's, like, we got that announcement. I was like, oh, like, 3 more seasons, this is so great. And then we were, like, awesome. And then, like, then, you know, 3 years later, we were like, oh.
Side note, Toon Gal has made a Korra Cards Against Humanity deck.
Ooh,
and she says, crossed out, she says, also, I didn't do this just to have an excuse to play CH with FTSW host again. What are you talking about? Well, I think you will have.
Dylan thinks I cheat at Cards Against Humanity. With Allie, even though there's no way to cheat in that game. Like, how, like,
it's actually impossible.
I literally say one thing. I'm like, Allie, pick the right card. And he accuses me of cheating.
Well, you do cheat because you have a cyclic link with Allie.
I don't
so.
Cheat.
Anyway.
Okay, you know what? That just, I can't control that.
You can't control that cyclic. I don't know. But my point, I guess one point is, I'm still going to be around the fan. I'll still be on Skype with talking with you guys, of course. And I'll still be on my Tumblr for you listening to ask questions with and stuff. And we'll all be here.
No one ever does.
And it's not like the fandom's going to be gone. I mean, I'm going to make a post tomorrow on the DF Tumblr being like, you know, I'm still going to update this blog with Avatar franchise news. Like, it's still...
Can I miss you going?
What is that Aang Legacy book that's eventually...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really care about that. I don't really care about that, but whatever. But yeah, there's something with.
I'll go to cons and then fan fiction will.
Go to cons where there's no panels.
Yeah, just show up in up dressed as Korra, and then find all the other people dressed as Korra.
Yes.
There you go.
Very important. Yes. Yeah.
Take
all the people
just have
Korra dressed as Korra in that dress.
In that dress. Oh my god. The cosplay.
It's all me in the dress.
Asami in that dress, though. Yeah.
That's such a pretty dress. I want that dress so bad. Someone make it for me.
Okay, Britt.
We finally have an Entertainment Weekly recap of Korra film. Nice. I will read this. Anyway.
Only Korra song.
I don't know. What else, guys? Anything else to end on? Not to end on, but just like any last words on this?
No.
I'm Guru Korosami. I'm finally alive. Like, yes.
You are a thing now, yeah.
I am a thing. Come to my blog, attack.
Meanwhile, my blog URL has got slowly and slowly less less relevant.
What are you going to do, Mel? Like, you named your blog after the podcast.
Oh, I don't care about that. I meant the fact that Allie never logs on anymore.
Yeah, I was like, the thing is, like, it's just Mel now.
Ask Mel stuff. Allie's not here anymore.
Yeah, no, she literally, I don't even know why I have her name still in the URL.
Oh, I guess at the end. Let me read some.
She has she controls the email though to that blog, so I need to.
Why are we talking about this on?
Last thing, I got email from RTR who's been talking about the Sith Opal series. I guess let me read part of this or some of this. I forgot to get to this. RTR says, I think both Opal and Kai were supposed to be there to challenge the ideas of airbending. Doing this by us seeing the consequences of clashing two ideals and trying to mold them this late in life. I think Bryke honestly wanted to do this and create two subsets of airbending culture. For example, the original airbenders in the north and south air temples, and Opal takes her people to the western eastern temples to train, going off of Avatar/Master Yang Chen's idea of doing what must be done to get the job done, no matter the cost. The clip of the clip episode really hurts this and probably made Bryke scrap the idea. This is why Opal's arc is no, disagree.
You know what would be interesting? If, like, 50 years, well, more than 50 years, like, however many hundreds of years from now, like, there's this whole, like, elitist idea in airbending of people who are, like, actually descended from Aang and Tenzin and stuff.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, and, like, versus people who are, like, descended from, like, the people who gained airbending because of the,
like,
portals.
Dao.
One point I want to make is that...
Somebody needs to write the fanfic.
Please don't say that things in the story didn't happen because of the clip show and the budget cut. I think that happened during the season planning stages, so, like, that didn't affect... Anyway, continuing, Opal and the others could adopt the old airbender tattoos the originals had. This would symbolize that every airbender, not just masters, can have tattoos and do great things. That was from Opal's ideology she got from her mom as well, the originators had too. Opal and her followers would claim they were the true airbenders. Having seen Kuvira's weapon firsthand, Opal realizes to survive the most potential of airbending, you need to adapt. Jinora/Tenzin Air Nation as well, the Air Nations living in a post-Kuvira world. Opal is a strong supporter of the elements. having the power and potential the others realize. Like, her grandmother, Opals, discovers using airbending in ways thought impossible, for example, using sound bending to influence and control the other elements in a sense, as well as redirecting. Basically, RTR is with me in being disappointed in where they went with Opal. Like, they could have just totally had this, like, just let this philosophy disagreement on airbending. And I really like your idea, RTR, of going, it's like Opal's sect and Jinora's sect of airbending, two different philosophies into the
they
future.
They have, like, a rift in, like, 10 years.
Yeah.
And completely, like, section off.
Yeah, which is basically what he's suggesting, like, different air temples for different ones. I think that'd be really cool. That'd be a cool comic to see. That's going to be what happens in the Jinora airbending show that comes after this. Yeah.
Yeah.
That will never be
voiced by someone who isn't Kieran Shipka, possibly.
I mean,
her older so her voice can be different.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Kiernan's great, though. I love Kiernan. She's the Mad Men finale. Mad Men series finale next year. Ah. Okay. Anyway, random note. I don't know. Opal's arc, I think, was good in book 4, despite it, you know, not going where we wanted it to. That's the thing. It's like we kind of have to let go, enter the void, and detach ourselves from our preconceived notions of the season. And this is what we have.
Yep.
Okay, I've kind of rambled on for 40 minutes now.
And the wrapping up here 40 minutes later.
Yeah. Wrapping up, I don't know. Any last thoughts on anything?
No.
I've been your main host, Delaney. The hosts have been Delaney, Ben, Mel, Britt. Technical directors AJ, Kevin, Jeff. Allie didn't show up. Musical credits the Yoshida
she's
brothers, Jeremy
a lot.
Zuckerman,
she has a fever
Luke Tripp.
She's like coughing.
Aww, poor Allie. It's
poor Allie. Logan Bennett
by
Kevin.
She's angry because she doesn't know where it came from.
Dong Wufeng's owned by Jake. Special contributor
does
Garrett.
She
contributors
know how germs work?
Sierra, Nick, Devin, and Lexi, Colin, Gretchen.
Why don't you ask her, Britt?
Britt, Nathan, Jamie.
See how that goes.
G Millionaire, Sierra, Miss, Nick, and Everything to Booty, Coin Fetching, Opal, Janora, Janora, Iroh.
You know, people who find this podcast in this day and age have no idea who Jake is.
Yeah, I know, it's weird. Someone asked me on Tumblr who Jake was. I was like, what?
I barely
it's
know who
Jake.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't
it's
know
it's Jakers.
Jake
I barely
know Jakers, who that's who it is.
Jakers.
What if Jake like just listened to this podcast
and then heard us
say Jakers? Yeah, that'd be funny.
He like sends an angry message via Skype. He's like, I'm gonna stop paying bills for you.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't really matter anymore. Sad. Because the show's over. Dongwufeng.net/podcast. You at Dongwufeng, Tumblr, Twitter, Dylan at Dongwufeng.net. Really leave us reviews on iTunes. Fine. You can ask me anything at DylanFTSW.tumblr.com. So yeah, there's going to be a few more podcasts before the next college semester starts up. And then potentially,
are we going to have a goodbye podcast?
Well, no, because I think I'm going to leave the potential open for just random podcasts whenever we feel like after that. And
for the rest of our lives.
Yes,
and people ask about a spinoff podcast. If we're doing anything, the problem is I need to do it very professionally and I would want to make money on it, which is incredibly difficult to do. And so it would be a general animation podcast if that's what we do, because I feel like that's the only angle we would have to go into a larger field. That's the only specialty we have. And it's not that we like artists or anything, but we've discussed that for years, and that's what we would do, and it would be a lot of work. Website, new podcast, professional equipment, stuff like that, you know. So it's not something as simple as just starting up another podcast.
No.
Yeah. But it's the potential in the future. I might want to look into it. I mean, I have developed podcast hosting skills for the last 7 years or whatever, so I could apply that.
That's how we all get jobs. We become the new...
But Allie actually asked me about something. She was like, should I put the podcast in my resume?
I mean, I think Jeff has it on his resume, actually.
I forget what it was. Well, Jeff like does technical stuff with it, so it's like important.
Everyone calls it my job.
It's your, yeah.
I mean,
it was
like doing skills. We have to act. We don't have to act professionally.
I mean, I act professionally.
I mean, they would never listen to it.
And then you all come on late, so that's what happens. Okay, what do we want to end on?
Bourbon Brit, definitely.
That doesn't revolve really to the show.
It revolves a great deal.
It relates to the podcast.
Relates to the podcast, okay. The hashtag, if you want to talk about this podcast, is #abourbonbrit.
It's
trending on Twitter.
Trending on Twitter, yeah.
Person? I don't know.
Bourbon Brit.
What's that?
Anyway, I don't want to end on that, though. Like,
okay. Well, what do you want to end on, though?
I don't know. Coruscant thing again. We did.
Yeah, let's just say that. I'm fine with that.
I don't know what happened. I don't know. Thanks for listening, guys. And this isn't. We'll have more podcasts again. There's again 3 to 4 more scheduled ones. Thank you guys for listening, though, throughout all of the season and throughout all the books. And I don't know. It means a lot to me. And things you guys say mean a lot to me and stuff like that because we do put a lot of effort into it.
That's cute.
Hooray. Yes.
Give us positive reviews on the
iTunes. Hooray. I mean, there you go. And you could send asks or something. I don't know. But anyway, what do we end on?
I can't help you.
Okay, so...
just make me so darn happy.
Yeah, there you go. We didn't even discuss that at all, though. Bourbon, Brit, or Coruscant, whatever you want to end on.
Bourbon, Brit.
See, now you've got me torn.
There's two really good ones, you know? Anyway, thanks for listening,
guys.
Bourbon, Coruscant. 1, 2, 3, Coruscant.
Coruscant.
Bourbon, Brit.
Coruscant. You guys are terrible.